I have never, ever been involved in such a phenomenal sports extravaganza as WrestleMania 3. It comes to the Silverdome in Pontiac, Michigan, the date, March the 29th, the time, 4 p.m., and from top to bottom, with all the great World Wrestling Federation superstars and all of the superstars from virtually every facet of entertainment. They're all going to be part of it, and you can be part of it. One way or another, come on in, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. You talk about WrestleMania 3. You talk about the Intercontinental title. You're going to be going against Macho Man Randy Savage. The big news at this point, you've got George the Animal Steel in your corner.
That's correct, Gene. We've got the biggest day of the year. The biggest wrestling extravaganza, like you said, ever to come about. You've got friend against friend. You've got two strong men going against each other. Then you've got you and I, Randy Savage, a man this year voted the rule breaker of the year. The man that has tried to put me out of professional wrestling, I mean, for good. For good. I've asked this question 100 times, and I'll ask you one more time. When you come off that top rope with that 20-pound bell, how much control did you have on that? You had none. Bottom line, you had none, my friend. Now we're coming to March the 29th, the biggest day of the year, and you've got your championship on the line. My friend, I'm giving it everything I've got to take it away from you.
Aloha. I thank you very much. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
So sometimes in wrestling, when the guy with the book doesn't know what the hell to do with you, he puts you in a tag team, and the wrestling gods have joined forces today. The Sportscasters and Greetings from Allentown, the new Power Podcast tag team. What's up, Peter Winston? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing all right here. You know, I was trying to think of a special name for this sort of thing. And I was coming up totally blank, but kind of since you're a big hockey fan and I'm a big hockey fan, perhaps to combine that with wrestling, maybe we should be the Hockey Talk Men.
Hey, that works for me.
I know, it's a terrible pun.
That works for me. I couldn't think of a name at all either. And I was like, well, I don't even know how to describe what we're doing. But look, the idea came, I don't know where it came from, but about a year ago I noticed that the Place to Be Nation was doing this giant project with WWF/e-wrestlers, and they were going to rank them from 1 to 100, and they were going to elicit the internet to help them. And I made a list. I sat down. I joined the groups, and I listened to the podcasts, and I watched stuff on the network, and I made a list of 1 to 100 and submitted it. And today, Peter and I are going to break it down in a few minutes. But before we get to that, Peter, I have to think that, and a big reason you didn't do a list, I have to think that they got over 100 of these, and I have to think as they look at them, they can pretty quickly identify when a person was most intensely a wrestling fan based on their list. That would be my guess. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. You can definitely tell by, like, who they rank at the very top. There's one name in particular, but, you know, we'll get to him when we get to him. You can sort of see it in like the biases of I listen to a lot of podcasts, and a lot of people are that in the podcasts that I listen to are probably about 3 to 7 years younger than me. See, I'm born 79, so they're probably born like 82 to 87. So they seem to have more of a sweet spot of like that 92, 93 WWF time frame. Whereas me, I go back more 88, 89, because it always comes down to when you were first introduced to the product, you're always going to look at it with rose-colored glasses, no matter whether it was good or bad. And I'm sure that there are 1995 WWF fans out there just because that was the year they started watching. And It's really, you know, kind of like that. However, when it comes to me not doing a ballot, I do wish that I did do a ballot at the end of the day. I had mistakenly thought that I was just going to be completely unfair to everybody who, you know, had their career primarily between, let's say, 2003 and 2012, because I was not watching really at all at that point. There's only so much catch-up work you can do
or want to do with that,
evaluating the full body of work for those guys. I mean, I can't. I feel like how can I judge Carlito when, and I know Carlito didn't make the place to be top 100, not even close, but how can I properly judge Carlito when I literally never saw him on a weekly television show for his entire career? So that was kind of the process there.
And I understood that, but I think, well, a few things. One is that David Shoemaker, the masked man, he wrote some really incredible wrestling obits back in the day for Deadspin, and wrote a really good book called The Squared Circle, and now he works for Ringer, where he writes about wrestling occasionally, but he also does the art direction for that website. But he was on my Sportscasters podcast, and he said something that I always thought was the smartest thing anyone said to me about wrestling. He said, wrestling exists in people's past. And he didn't even mean it as a negative, just that, you know, that like you were kind of talking about rose-colored glasses and the first things you watched. The very first angle I ever seen was the build-up to Hogan and Bundy at WrestleMania 2. That was the very first thing I seen, and I didn't see WrestleMania 2 until it got to video stores, but I don't hate WrestleMania 2 like some do. Like, you know, I have that kind of nostalgic love for it, you know, and much like you, my sweet spot is usually, you know, about 86 to 90 in there. So we come from a pretty similar era, but I just think that my guess, my argument to you about it, which I thought why you should do one, is my guess is that everyone has probably has blind spots, and that everyone's blind spots would sort of kind of average out somehow. You know what I mean? Like I doubt that there's anyone, or maybe there's a few, I shouldn't say anyone, because there are diehards, but there's got to be at least a strong percentage of the electorate here tapped out for some segment of years in their life. I just have to think it happened.
I think another part of it is in doing my podcast where I'm looking at weekly television shows, you know, from really from 1980 to 1999 is what I've covered so far, but I'll probably end up going before that time frame and after that time frame at some point. I could have just done only WWF, WWE shows and just kind of focused in like that. I mean, I could do a podcast with just that. I didn't really want to just kind of do only one promotion. I kind of laugh though, because I notice I have no idea if the listener metrics that I see are actually real, but I get more listens for the WWE WWF shows that I post, but I feel compelled to do a WCW show because there's a different kind of humor in covering all that. And, you know, I want to learn stuff. Like, that's why I'm doing a show on Memphis. By the time this is released, I'll have done a show on Memphis wrestling from 1989. So I wanted to kind of continue my like learning curve and doing that. And I thought, well, if I jump into this project, I'm going to be really distracted and I'm going to run out of time, and you know, I'll kind of, you know, the podcast might suffer. I do think I was probably mistaken. I could have done both. And in breaking down your list, which we're going to be doing here, I kind of had that those pangs again, because I'm going through and I'm like, oh, how could Steve leave off this guy or this or that, or questioning, or oh, I wish you had this guy higher or lower. And I was like, oh, and you know, I could have had my voice heard, but you know, hey, nobody wants to hear me flap my gums about how I didn't cast a ballot, because we're here to actually break down a real ballot here. So
right, and we'll take a break in a minute, and we'll do that. I'm trying to think if there's anything else before we do get to that. Oh, I was thinking about you were talking about your podcast, and one of the things I love about it is learning about some of the wrestling I didn't watch. I mean, I didn't watch really much WCW at all over the years. I did watch Saturday Night when I was at my dad's house as a kid quite a bit, but it didn't translate to me getting a pay-per-view or tracking down their other TV. So I do learn about names I know from WWF and their careers in WCW or another federation. So I do appreciate that part about your podcast. So I'm glad it's not just WWF, even though those are my favorite episodes. I still do like, you know, you did an episode this week about the saddest day of my life as a wrestling fan and probably my top three saddest days of my life as a human this week. And I did enjoy listening to that. And I love whenever I see, you know, WWF 87 or 88, I'm pumped to hear that. But I do appreciate, like you said, the ability to learn something else when I see WCW, you know, 83 or WCW 89 or something. My favorite episode you've done, though, is the one that you did for, what was it, December of 84 or 83? The one right before Hogan won the belt, when Sheik was still champion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's been my favorite one so far.
I'll give you a peek behind the curtain on that one, because I do like to line up episodes with either certain things in my life or certain parts of the calendar. Like last year, I did an episode of Maple Leaf Wrestling because I was going to Canada. And since I'm going to Canada at the end of February, that means another Maple Leaf Wrestling is going to be on its way soon. That one there, of course, it was around New Year's, so not that long ago. I had actually, on my blog, section309.com, I had actually already covered that episode with a write-up. So I kind of had a lot of the research done, but, you know, with, like, different bits and whatnot. Like, I didn't have the bit with the Godfather and Red Don and all that. That kind of came with the podcast, because that wouldn't really work in a written form.
Right.
So I had a lot of the research done. And with it being around Christmas and New Year's, and I had to go to Long Island for Christmas and traveling and work, because I had to work and all that, it allowed me to do a show in a shorter period of time for that one. But I was very happy with how that one came out, because that's just a really fascinating time during that window of the end of Backlund and the beginning of Hogan. I mean, it's a four-week thing, and yet I've managed to do two shows from that 4 week period already.
Yeah, I almost wish Cheeky Baby was the champ a little bit longer, you know?
But you had to have Hogan destroy him.
Oh, of course.
Immediately. It's like he's there, and you didn't need to incubate him in any way. He was all set, ready to go. He was the pre made meal.
Yeah,
they had purchased.
It was certainly time to unleash the beast there. I understand. I just wish that somehow in an alternate universe, there'd be a couple more shows with Cheeky Baby Champ, you know what I mean? Just a couple more to take in. But all right, well, I think we can plug stuff at the end, so we won't clog that up now. I think we got a little bit of a decent background, so what we'll do is we'll take a break, and we'll come back and we'll unveil the bottom half of my list, 100 to 50.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
All right, we are back. Peter Winson from Greetings from Allentown and Steve Bennett from the Sportscasters here. We're going to start breaking down my top 100 WWF E wrestlers list as part of the Place to Be Nation project. Real quick, I wanted to go over, Peter, how I did this. So there was about 330 or 40 or something like that eligible wrestlers that you could rank. There was a process beforehand where people had to be nominated and then seconded, you know, this kind of a thing. And what I did is I went through that list one by one, and it was alphabetical. And anyone who I thought might make my 100, I put in one of four categories. The first category was the Vince Senior category. Then I had the Rock and Wrestling category. Then I had the attitude category, and then I had the modern category. So I sort of organized them that way. And obviously some guys cross over, so I just put them where I kind of knew them best.
Yeah.
Right. So like someone like, I don't know, Hulk Hogan maybe could have stretched out a couple of lists. I just put him in Rock and Wrestling because that's where I knew him best. So I had these kind of vague four quadrants, and I think I got it down to about 175 guys. And then I just started from the top and worked my way down. And I will say right off the top that I absolutely believed in my mind that I thought Jesse Ventura was on my list. I just thought I had him on there, but he's not. So
I saw that he came in between, I think it was 175 and 200 on the final list there. And, you know, in approaching this, I wasn't sure if as a performer being an announcer would actually count with it being a greatest wrestler or if it's contribution to wrestling. So it's kind of a gray area there. I've said many times that he is the greatest color guy of all time just because of the logic that he would inject and sort of treating it as a real sport while also being hilarious at the same time.
Yeah,
as a wrestler, do you have any Jesse Ventura matches that you really enjoyed though?
See, that's the thing. I mean, when I got to some of the older guys that I knew I wanted to rank, I would try to watch a couple matches, try to remember a few, try to go from things I've read in books. You know, the way that we judge history, we weren't around for. I tried to – the criteria itself didn't lend very well to including some of those guys. But sometimes, you know, I said I can only follow the criteria so closely because in the end it's my list. You know what I mean? I can't put a guy at 15 that I don't believe is 15 because it maybe works best for the given criteria. So I certainly followed it, and it definitely held guys back because, I mean, for managers, for example, like you weren't supposed to count their work as managers, and you were supposed to somehow be able to separate promos that they gave for matches as opposed to promos they gave for managing. But that's impossible because when you've heard a promo, you heard the promo. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like Bobby Heenan has done plenty of promos when he's going to wrestle. You know, like at WrestleMania 4, he gave a promo before his match with the Islanders against the Bulldogs and Coco, right? And it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he's also given promos. He also gave a promo that day when he was a manager. But I don't know how to separate them in my mind because it's just one guy giving promos. So I already know how I believe he is at promos, regardless of what he's talking about. So I did find the criteria challenging at times, but in the end, I just tried to hold true to, hey, this is my list, and I have to be as close to my what I think is right as I can. Why don't we just start giving some names, and then we can go from there and see how the discussion leads us.
Okay.
All right. So I'll give you five quick names, and you tell me what you think. So my number 100 wrestler wouldn't probably make it if I was being honest. But for that number 100 spot, I wanted to put someone in there, almost a kind of a little bit of a wink of the eye. And my number 100 is the Haiti kid who is just, you know, he's just a fantastic little guy wrestler. He's my number one little guy wrestler. Oh, wait, you know what? We should back up. I didn't rank any women.
Yes, I did. I did notice that. And, you know, I think that's a call that a lot of people might have had to make. And I do think that, you know, it would have been cool if there was a side project where you rank the women, say, top 25 or top 50 and kind of have that as a separate thing. Because to kind of work them into the mix there and comparing the styles is going to be extremely difficult for somebody to get a truly fair shake, I think.
I have nothing against women's wrestling, especially, I mean, in 2018, there's fantastic athletes doing it, you know, great workers, people have worked very hard. I just don't know how to compare them. You know, I've never been a real fan of women's wrestling, just personally, because I grew up in an era where it was largely just disregarded and kind of ignored. So I never grew up caring about it. And I've had a hard time transitioning in 2018. And I do have a little bit of problem sometimes with believability. You know, there'll be a wrestler in the ring, like Alexa Bliss, maybe, if that's her name. And I look her up, and she's 5'3", 118 pounds, and she's wrestling Charlotte. And they don't do anything to make me believe why she could defeat Charlotte. Like, they don't tell me, well, she's a great submission person, or they don't give me any reason to believe she could beat her in a fight. I've really struggled with getting behind it, so I guess I took the easy way out and said I'm just not ranking them at all.
I think that even if I approach this list where I said, okay, I'm not going to consider women's wrestling, you know, as part of this list, I probably still would have ranked Sensational Sherry anyway, just simply for her run with Randy Savage in 89 and 90, because she was getting physically involved and actually was part of those matches from time to time. And obviously, she did have a wrestling career as well, but you know, just her, because she was mixing it up with the men on a level that you weren't going to see, you know, even in that time frame, and especially nowadays where it's pretty much verboten in WWE. I know, I guess Lucha Underground was doing some stuff with that, but I don't know much about that. At all, but you're 100 there, to go back to that with
the Haiti kid.
Now, when you do a list like this, number 100 should be something for vanity purposes,
right?
In my opinion,
that was my thought as well.
And had I done a list, I probably would have listed somebody who would have been, you know, oh, maybe this person shouldn't qualify, but I want them on my list, like a Dr. D. David Schultz or a Bad News Brown. Somebody like that, who I really like the character, but they might not fit in otherwise. For the Haiti kid, though, for the midgets or the minis, as they're now known, you know, I don't know how he might compare with, say, a Hornswoggle, more modern. But he certainly had more moments than the other ones.
I'll tell you why he made the list. On the pit. Yes, two reasons he made the list. He got his head shaved and was in Mr. T's corner. And he did a pre-tape on Gorilla Monsoon's lap. So, that's the main reason I included him. I mean, he sat on Gorilla's lap and did a pre-tape. I mean, how can you beat that? I mean, it's the greatest moment in midget wrestling, I think, when the Haiti kid sat on Gorilla's lap and did a pre-tape. That's great. So that's why he made it. 99 was Tyson Kidd. I think that, unfortunately, Samoa Joe sent him to early retirement, but I thought his Cesaro tag team with Cesaro was the best tag team since like the 90s. And if that run,
yeah, it's all too brief.
Yeah,
but Cesaro, one of the best tag team guys of this era. I kind of consider him like the Bret Hart. Oddly enough, teaming with Tyson Kidd, who's part of that extended family there. And yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about where that might have gone. That was June 2015, so it's been a while since that happened.
98, I have George the Animal Steel, mostly on the strength of his feud with Savage. You don't want him on there,
I'm going to be triggered by George Steel again.
Yeah, he's polarizing, I understand. He's very polarizing. But he did a 14-month
feud. Well, talked about on my show.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying how, like, I talked about on my show how Animal Steel would always trigger me by appearing in the intro to Wrestling Spotlight years after he retired, when I felt like that spot should have gone to somebody who was actually working in the promotion, and how I would always get the George Steel ice cream bar from the truck after the Little League game instead of getting Savage or anybody else. It's like George Steel is he's a nemesis of mine. It's like I feel like I'm walking around, I feel like Macho Man from 86, 87. I can't get George Steele out in any way.
And that's why I included him. I mean, I was such an impressionable wrestling fan in that era, and I used to love Saturday Night's Main Event more than anything, because I would stay up late with my dad, and I would fight to keep my eyes open when it finally started, and He was always in those matches with Savage, and I just felt like I had to have him on. Then I have Batista, and at 96 I had Hacksaw Jim Duggan, who is probably, you know, these last few, I mean, honestly, there's like 15 or 16 guys. And there's almost, you know, the Batista, Steel, Duggan especially, because I knew I wanted Kid and Kid 199. So really the next three are my last three in, and I had like 16 guys I wanted to put on the list. You know,
I do think Duggan suffered a bit from perhaps some of the limitations of what Vince McMahon wants from his wrestling. Like, if they had let him just be purely a wild style brawler, if we had gotten to see more of the Duggan brawling backstage with Harley Race at the 87 Slammies, like that Duggan, and a little bit, yes, a little bit less of the Uncle Sam waving the flag Duggan, which was a fine character in terms of popularity with the crowds and all that. If purely a brawler, I think he gets remembered a lot better by the hardcore wrestling fan and would probably rank higher, I think, on everybody's list.
The next group of five I have from 95 to 91, I have Hercules, Brutus the Barber, Beefcake, The Miz, Harley Race, and Terry Funk. Obviously, Race and Funk did a majority of their work elsewhere, but I thought they did just enough to squeeze in. Race and his matches with Hogan at MSG, really good, and some of his work with Heenan and the JYD feud at 3. If you were on WrestleMania 3, you probably got a lot more points than you should have in the peak the peak performance section of the criteria. WrestleMania 3 is the greatest day in wrestling history to me, so I certainly weighted the WrestleMania 3 characters quite a bit. Miz, I think, is a guy who is climbing the list rapidly.
I think he's peaked the last year and a half, 2 years. Is just the best pure heel that they have in WWE, who doesn't go out of his way to seek cheers in any way. He's very kind of old school in that way.
Any other comments about that group, or should we move on?
Yeah, well, Beefcake there, having him there, he's there, I think, for his 89, which I think was
absolutely
pretty good, coming off a disappointing, you know, deal with the Honky Tonk Man. Terry Funk, it's a shame that his run was so short. If it was a little bit longer, if he had stuck around after WrestleMania 2, maybe tag with Dory, go for the tag titles with the Bulldogs, that would have been a fantastic feud. It's funny, when they had the Greatest Wrestler Ever project at PWO several years ago, I wasn't voting in that because I wasn't a member there at that time. You know, in listening to all the stuff, I actually would have ranked Terry Funk number one greatest wrestler of all time. But, of course, that encompasses his entire
right
legendary career. Here, you're only talking about Terry Funk from 85 into early 86. And then,
his,
you know,
Chainsaw,
the little
Charlie stuff, yeah.
Chainsaw Charlie, Your Mother's a Whore from the Shotgun in 97. But Terry Funk also had maybe the greatest moment in the history of Tuesday Night Titans when he bashed Tony Garea over the head with a beer bottle. One of my favorite segments ever.
You know, Funk's a guy, too, that squeezed in probably because of listening to the Refresh, the Place to Be Nation, the flagship show, and watching some of those MSGs and seeing some of the matches he had in 85 at MSG is probably a big reason he snuck in. From 90 to 86, I had Mr. T at 90. I know that that's going to be one. I mean, he's a guy who's already been unveiled, so he didn't finish very high. He wasn't on many lists. You know, but he basically was in the co-main event of WrestleMania 2, so I wasn't going to keep him off. Pat Patterson is next there. Bob Orton, Lex Luger, and Big John Studd at 86. Big John Studd also, he won the 89 Royal Rumble and was in one of the biggest matches in WrestleMania 1. Gets him on my list. Thoughts on that group?
Okay, so when I saw Patterson at 89, I was relieved that he was on your list. He is the greatest example, and Bob Backlund is kind of in this club too, and we'll be getting to him at some point here. Patterson is one of those guys that you take, you know, a fan who's maybe younger than me. And hell, I wasn't even exposed to Pat Patterson, perhaps a bad choice of words there. You know, his work, you don't see very much of it because in ring, he's not really there after 1983. But you go back and you watch his matches with Backlund in 79, and then you see his stuff with Angelo Mosca, Ivan Koloff, and then, of course, the king of it all, the Sergeant Slaughter Cobra Clutch angle from 1981. Patterson's greatest hits just from that time period in 81 with the Mosca water pitcher angle, the Cobra Clutch challenge, and then Koloff was actually in 83. Some really high quality stuff. All the best angles of the early 80s, save for Zbyszko and Bruno, are centered around Patterson. He's a guy that I definitely encourage. If you haven't seen his matches from the time period, go out of your way to watch that sort of stuff. Bob Orton, he's a good enough worker. I'm certainly in the club of people who like him more than his son. I do think he's certainly one of the best background guys. Like, sometimes you need somebody to just stand in the background and smirk and look menacing. And Orton was very good in that role alongside Piper and Orndorff as well in the build to WrestleMania 1.
And Adonis and with the pink cowboy hat.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That stuff was fantastic as well. And then Luger there at 87, I don't think that there's a guy who – I don't think there's a bigger gap in how WCW and WWF utilized a guy in terms of how they were misused. I do think Rick Rude has that sort of deficit where WCW used him a lot better than WWF did. But Luger, they just cast him as an all-American patriot when he hates people. why did you decide that this guy does not even like to slap hands with the fans as a baby face? He has his head down. It's just like, oh. But, you know, in ring, all of his best stuff is elsewhere.
He might be a top 20 WCW guy, maybe.
What's the best Lex Luger WWF match, like just off the top of your head?
Jeez, maybe Yokozuna, WrestleMania 10? The SummerSlam match.
The first thing that I was inclined to say was Luger versus Mr. Perfect WrestleMania 9.
I thought that's a good one.
Stunk because it had a crappy finish.
Yeah.
Honestly, his best WWF moment might have been the interview at WrestleMania 8 with the snapping the fingers right. And then having the milk brought to him. I mean, that's pretty much it.
You know where Luger's great is his shoot interview stuff, like his kayfabe commentary stuff. If you get a chance to watch him there, he's really good. He's just a really good person in that role, like being interviewed. And I think he's changed his life over the years. You know, as the guy who hated people in the 80s, he's a different guy now. And he's really good if you watch his U shoot or whatever they call it, or his kayfabe.
I have seen a little of one of those, and my initial thought was, wow, this is much better than the time he was on Flair's podcast and Flair just interrupted him every 5 minutes to tell him how Luger didn't sell out any arenas in the South. Are you so Charlie? You know, all that stuff.
Number 85, I had Big Show. 84, I had Kane. 83 was Vader. 82, Taz, and 81, RVD. I wanted to get a couple of the ECW guys on the list. I know they had their best stuff, obviously, there. Taz's in-ring stuff is kind of short in WWE. I was just such a big fan of him that it was hard to keep him off my list. So I snuck him in the first 20 there, or the bottom 20. Big Show, maybe I underrate a little bit. I bet he's a little bit higher on some lists of people who are watching more in the 2000s than me. And Kane, I know a lot of people have Kane fatigue, but just for as long as he's stuck around with that character, I couldn't see not including him. I think he's been just such a big part of the company.
Yeah, he's sort of like a hockey player who plays for 22 years, but somehow he accumulates 520 goals. So you got to put him in the Hall of Fame here. Like, you know, there's a lot of crap with Kane just over time. It, you know, so much has been said about some of the various angles, but you have to be pretty decent to stick around for 20 consecutive years in one place. So I think he definitely has a place on the list. I really wasn't seeing it with Taz. I love Taz in ECW from 97 through 99. I think he's awesome. I think
amazing.
It's one of the best characters that there ever has been in history of wrestling.
The War Machine. The War Machine, yes, is perfect. The perfect theme song too. Killer.
Yeah, that character, like, really, really made me believe. And this is, you know, at a time when you had every reason not to believe in anything, given all that was out there. With Vader in WWF, like, his tenure, everybody talks about, oh, it was disappointing. People kind of write off the fact that he was pretty much hurt from day one. I mean, he was just – so I kind of look at him like he is a big free agent signing for a sports team who was just injury plagued and just never got untracked. Remember Grant Hill with the Orlando Magic, which was actually around that time in the mid to late 90s, where he signs with the Orlando Magic. It might have been 2000.
He's just always got a foot injury. He's just always
hardly ever played for them. Yeah. Like, but, and that's kind of what it feels like with Vader. Like, he was there and he had some high profile matches, and, you know, he wasn't bad by any means, and all he gets remembered for is for saying that, you know, he's a big fat piece of you know what.
Right. let me ask you this. I know you have a list of 19 omissions there. Do you see some guys that you might have included in this segment, this 81 to 100? Are there some guys on your omissions that this is about where you might have slotted them?
Yeah, a couple that come to mind. Dr. D. David Schultz might have been my vanity pick for number 100, just because I'm legitimately afraid of him. And with him being a bounty hunter, I feel like he might track me down if I talk bad about him on my podcast. So I always say good things about him. Bad News Brown, who was terrible as an in-ring worker, but just an amazing character. Like, I don't know why that character just connects with me. It's very similar to Stone Cold Steve Austin. If you actually listen to what he's saying and how anti-authoritarian, he's always hung up on what Jack Tunney was doing.
And one of the all-time great double crosses at WrestleMania 4, too.
Oh, yeah. And getting that giant trophy and having it broken on him. He was the first to double cross the Hitman. Mm-hmm. Vince stole his gimmick.
He sure did.
So, yeah. Also looking at Farouk as well, and D'Lo Brown, two members of the Nation of Domination. I was always kind of a big D'Lo fan over time, and he got kind of stuck with a couple of bad breaks in terms of storyline, and of course the unfortunate Darren Drozdov accident that took place, and Drozdov got injured and paralyzed as a result of it. Those are guys who I think would have found a home there towards the bottom. And I also think maybe Ivan Koloff as well, seeing as though he kind of gets ignored because he disappears around the same time that Bob Backlund does. In fact, I don't even think you see Ivan Koloff in the WWF after January 84. And it's interesting because he was the guy who beat Bruno in 71 and was always a strong heel presence when he would be in the territory right up through the end of 1983. I'm not sure what got him blackballed or whatever. It's just something, he doesn't seem to get acknowledged for what his actual place in history was.
At number 80, I had Haku. At number 79, I had Goldust, maybe similar to Kane in my thought process there. I had Dusty, then Earthquake, and 76, I had Don the Rock Morocco. Morocco is another example of a guy who, watching some of these MSG shows from the early 80s that I missed because I wasn't old enough yet, has skyrocketed up my list. I didn't realize how great he was because I thought he was that guy with Superstar Billy Graham for so long. And Morocco also gets a little bit of a WrestleMania 3 bump because I think that Can-Am Connection Morocco Orton match is one of the better openers of all the WrestleManias. I mean, it's not a Bret Hart Owen Hart type opener, but for what you're usually looking for in an opener, I think they accomplished it really well there. But that's the next five. Any thoughts on those fellas?
Yeah, my only comment with Goldust and Dusty Rhodes right there back to back is next to Goldust, I wrote, you know, he should be ahead of his dad on this list just for longevity's sake. When I wrote that, I was kind of forgetting about Dusty's little brief run in 78 with Superstar Graham and those bull rope matches.
Yeah, that awesome.
Like some pretty good stuff. So it's kind of fitting that you had Dusty Rhodes at number 78 there.
Right. I wish I could say I planned that.
Earthquake had a nice run there. I do think he's placed about where he should be. Now, Morocco gets a lot of grief for some of his lazy in-ring work. I think that he had some 60-minute draw with Backlund that was just brutal to sit through. I think it was on one of the review shows. Might have been Titans of Wrestling. But in watching Morocco and his promos, some of his promos, when he was a heel, were fantastic enough for me to just overlook any sort of laziness he might have had in the ring. I did that show from December of 83 where he did a promo on Patterson where he's yawning and picking his nose like boring. It's fantastic. Let it also be said that Magnificent Morocco was the guy who ate a sandwich while squashing some jobber, so he could be a fairly decent squash match worker. He was inspired in some way, so I am glad that he's on the list here.
75, I had Pillman. Then I had Snuka. I want to talk about him in a second. Rey Mysterio, probably way, way under what most people rank him. That's partly because his main run was when I was checked out. But I've catched up enough to understand his talent and made sure I included him. And then I have Rotunda and Wyndham. Their tag team in the early 80s was my uncle's favorite tag team. And he would constantly just ask me about them. And I'm like, they're not around anymore. And this is like 1990. You know, he would still be at, like, five, going on 6 years, he's asking me, you know, like, about them. But, man, I love their tag match, the first ever title change in WrestleMania history. WrestleMania 1 against Sheik and Volkov. And, you know, those are the guys that Real American was written for. So I gave them a bump for that, too. Before we get to your breakdown of those guys, I want to talk about Snuka for a second because I didn't rate Benoit. I left him off. I didn't feel right about giving him a spot. I know that I didn't see in the criteria whether we should consider, you know, murdering your family, but I just couldn't include him. And Snuka kind of falls on those same lines, but there's enough rumor and innuendo there. I mean, he was charged, I guess, much, much later in his life. I don't know if, I just didn't know what to do. I just put him on in the end. He probably would have been a little bit higher, maybe. I mean, he has one of the peak moments in the history of the promotion. So he might have been a little higher, but I just didn't know what to do with him. So I stuck him in there. What about these five guys? What are your thoughts and comments?
Yeah, to your point about Snuka, the back nine of his career there after he returned in 89, he had a few moments that first year, but by the time you get to 90 and 91, it's not good, not good at all. As for Pillman, I'm not entirely sure that in that 96-97 Nexus there that he did enough, but he's one of my favorite wrestlers of all time, so obviously you're going to get no argument from me there. In terms of Wyndham and Rotunda there, and they're kind of linked, it's fascinating to look at their careers just in this promotion as a whole, because you have their run with the U.S. Express and all that, and they're coming out to Born in the USA before they were supposed to have Real American, as you said, and how their careers later developed just within the WWF window, because Wyndham, by any account, as an overall wrestler, is more talented than Rotunda. I think just about everybody would agree with that. But if you take their second incarnations or their later incarnations in the WWF, they really flipped, because Rotunda as IRS was a step up for him because he's in one of the main events of WrestleMania 9 and always seemed to find himself in a somewhat prominent on-screen role. And with Wyndham, he has that Widowmaker run in 89, which is so weird because literally all he did was squash jobbers on TV. He's never right. He's never on a pay-per-view. He never loses a match the entire time by pinfall or submission anyway. And then he disappears because of all the stuff going on with his family. And then he comes back as the Stalker, which is just like really sort of joke stuff at that point. And then the new Blackjacks was just kind of, and the whole NWA invasion angle, that kind of puts a stink on him a little bit. That's very hard for him, I think, to shake. I do think he's about at the right spot on this list. I probably would have flipped IRS in Wyndham there just because of the IRS character is always a neat little comedy element, at least to me anyway.
Absolutely. You can make a good case there. 70, I had Captain Lou Albano. 69, Freddie Blassie. Devon Dudley, Bubba Dudley, and Dick Murdoch, not to be confused with HM. Any thoughts on these five guys? Captain Lou and Freddie, they had to get on there. They're probably not going to be on a lot of lists. You're going to ask me, like, what's my favorite Freddie Blassie match? I don't know. I honestly don't. But I know enough. This is one that would fall in, like, what was, you know, James Madison's best day as president? Well, I didn't live through it, but I can read enough about it to know where to place him. So that's my justification there. And the Dudley brothers, I mean, just for those TLC matches alone, I thought they had to be on the list. And Murdoch, again, someone historically, I think, fits on the list. And, I was looking ahead and knew I'd be able to give H.M. Murdoch a shout out here. So that was part of it, too. What do you think about these five guys?
Murdoch is definitely a guy that I wish had gotten more shots in this promotion at various points. He had the run with Adonis, the tag champions, in 84 and into early 85. And you don't really see him much after that. He makes that weird random appearance in the 95 Royal Rumble where he does the standing drop kick on somebody that caused me to, when I watched the 95 Rumble a couple of years ago, I marked out for that moment so much. And I like, I'm going to make a GIF file out of this and post it on my blog just because I loved it so much. And it was just completely out of nowhere. And then sadly, he passes away a year later in 96. With Blassie and Albano there, my one comment was, I wrote Grand Wizard, like, why did he have to die in 1983? Because those are the three wise men. They're forever linked as the three great managers of the Vince Sr. era. And they're all great promos, and they're all very distinct in their own way. Blassie and Wizard are probably more similar. Albano is kind of, you know, an outlier with the way he looked and presented himself. And Albano is very important in terms of what he meant to the rock and wrestling connection. If he's not on that airplane with Cyndi Lauper, as the story goes, right, who knows how things actually turn out. But the Grand Wizard is another guy who, you know, linked with those two guys in seeing more of his promos. And thank God for YouTube and being able to see this, because this is not something that you can see on the WWE Network. It's like there's nothing on there celebrating the Grand Wizard in any of his career. He dies in October of 1983. And I just like, oh, why did he have to pass away at that moment? Like, it could have been something had he lived for another year or two. I think he would have been replaced by one of the managers who had come in. But, that's kind of what I thought of. It made me think of him instead of actually Blassie or Albano. I don't know why.
If only he could have lived a little longer, I guess.
Yeah.
Number 65, I have Mr. Fuji. So devious And one of the great, just such a great moment when he runs the 5K before WrestleMania in his suit. Rick Martel, Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson, and Christian at 61. Tully and Arn, this is one where I feel qualified to talk about. There's it's a short period, but man, do they take some of these tag team matches are so great. The was it the 88 SummerSlam where they're in the first match against the Hart Foundation? Or is it the Bulldogs? 89. Just such a great match. It's like a 4+ star match to me. So many good. I need they're two guys I wish I had seen more of their WCW work, and I want to because I just love watching them as a tag team with Bobby. Probably higher than most people would put them, but I just love so many of their tag matches. And Christian, you know, again, his work in the TLCs and his stuff with Edge and even some of his single stuff, he deserved a spot. So what about those five? And then we'll look at the 20 and see who you might have put in. But let's do the five first.
All right, Christian is another example of a guy that I don't think I would have been fair to with my ballot. You're right, the TLC matches, he's certainly an integral part of that. Fuji is an interesting case because most people of our generation would think of him primarily as a manager. And, you know, as a wrestler, he was not any great shakes. You say Mr. Fuji, and the first thing that comes to mind is salt in the eye finishes.
Yes.
Both as a manager and as a wrestler. But, you know, he would be in some good pairings as tag team champions. Him and Saito around that 82 period had a great feud with Martel and Gurria. And you have Martel here at 64. And I think
that was part of the reason I put them so close. That feud was.
Yeah. Those two guys are linked not only from the early 80s, but also the Strike Force demolition thing.
Yep.
It's Fuji's Kane doing in sure Martel
yeah.
in 88. Martel, I talked about this on my own podcast, you know, episode 49, I think it was, where Martel kind of got pigeonholed as a tag team guy in WWF as kind of, you know, the babyface who comes in with the hot tag and then eventually, he doesn't get to be a real singles star until he becomes a heel, and then he's sort of kept at that little bit below IC level where he gets to challenge for the IC title from time to time. And I think they didn't get all that they could have out of him, in my opinion. I think Martel sometimes would come and go. He would take time off or whatever, which, you know, I respect that.
Wasn't his wife sick at one point? He needed to take some time off for his wife, like right in the Strike Force breakup period.
Yeah. So the second half of 88, he's not there. Martel, actually, he was supposed to be on the first WWF house show that I went to, and he wasn't there. I don't know if he no-showed or whatever. But and then the first WCW show I ever went to, Rick Martel was supposed to be there. And he wasn't there at that either. He no-showed that. Both of them in Boston. I'm like, Ricky, do you have like an arrest warrant out in Massachusetts? Like, what's going on here?
Everyone but in Boston are losers, he said. You're losers.
It's got to be that Montreal-Boston thing. Right? Yeah. He's a Canadian fan. Just doesn't want to set foot in the Boston Garden or Fleet Center. But I still love me some Ricky Martel. He's one of the best tag guys in the history of the promotion. And his single stuff is very good. The model stuff, he made that work. It took a little while for it to really get going. He had that weird pairing with Slick that just didn't seem to connect. And then when he put the big button on that said, yes, I am a model, like that was the moment where like, all right, now this is finally going to take off. But so I 64, I might have had him a smidge higher, but that might just be personal biases of that I like Martel.
Now in this from 80 to 61, is there any of your 19 that this is about where you might have slotted them?
I might have put Ken Patera up there, but he was so damaged by that run in 87 and 88 that it just really, you know, slides him off the list entirely. I think a lot of my omissions might have just been a little bit lower than that. Maybe Sheamus is another guy that I might have had around this time period. He's somebody that I've grown to appreciate a lot more in the last 2 years since his heel turn and the spiking of his hair like a red rooster for the 21st century. Like, I like that character a lot better instead of the John Cena Jr. thing that he was doing around 2014. And, you know, having a good character, that definitely helps you with me as well. And another tag guy who was primarily in tag teams, since we were looking at Arn and Tully, Rick Martel and Mr. Fuji, is Jacques Rougeau.
I wanted to get the Rougeaus in. I did.
Who is, I think, underrated as a character as the Mountie, which maybe he's not even underrated. It's just the things he was doing, just SummerSlam 91 in the jailhouse alone.
Oh, yeah, really good. Bits.
One of the first middle fingers you would ever see on WWF television with, you know, in the jailhouse. Even in the Quebecers, you know, good stuff. And just as the obnoxious heel in the fabulous Rougeau brothers, I think he always kind of outshone Raymond, who seemed like more of a subdued, chill sort of guy. Jacques was sort of the one that would, he was the one who suckered Dynamite Kid. He was always the one who was a little bit more forward than Raymond.
I couldn't believe how much he was bragging about that sucker punch on Mooney's podcast. I don't know if you heard that, but man, he is proud of that.
I haven't, but I think Dynamite made some enemies to
sure
the point
did, yeah.
where he could certainly feel free to brag about that, I think.
Number 60, I have Matt Hardy. Yep. And 59, I have Jim the Anvil Neidhart. I kind of put these guys next to each other in this spot because they're kind of the other guy in popular tag teams. Then I have Akeem, Barry Darso, and the Big Boss Man at 56. Boss Man, some of his Hogan stuff, his late stuff where he gets pinned to a cross, too bad, and he missed a spot in Austin at a Bell him out. I kind of forgave some of that stuff. I'm a huge Demolition guy, so I wanted to get both Demolition guys on there. I put Edie a little higher than Darso because I did. No, because I wasn't a big fan of Repo. And Boss Man a little bit ahead of Akeem. If you look at my list in general, I'm a big tag team guy, so I did get a lot of tag team guys in the bottom 50 here. But yeah, I think it's interesting how I put Anvil and Hardy there, with them, Matt Hardy there being, as you know, they're not Bret Hart and they're not Jeff Hardy. So what about these five?
Well, I think Matt Hardy is an example of a guy who right now could help himself a little bit with this little run that he's on, you know, seeing that he is still active. When I saw Jim Neidhart there, I kind of did start to get the sense that you're more of a tag team guy, because he was pretty miserable as a singles worker, which you'd see primarily on house shows, like the, you know, MSG house shows. This is like a Jim Neidhart versus Tony Atlas match, which is the cure for insomnia.
Right. I just think of Restolt. He's strong. He's all primary. He's on this list for being part of the Hart Foundation for sure. The Hart Foundation matches I love. I felt like he had to be on the list. And he was the mouthpiece of the foundation too, to a large extent. And he was great at that.
He needed to be the personality of that group because Brett wasn't going to be that.
Right.
From 85 to 87, was just not comfortable enough to be on that role. And to a lesser extent with Owen, although upon examination, that run, the new foundation, was like 3 months. So I almost feel like that it's not even enough of a sample size to really even account for that. As for Akeem at 58, that character change just completely saved him, because the gang had run its course and really wasn't going to, you know, do anything at that point. So and the way he committed to that Akeem character with the hand jive movements, and just it was total buy-in. It was like the exact opposite of the Red Rooster and Terry Taylor. As for the Big Boss Man at 56, it's a classic example of a guy who had two great distinct eras. And I'm not even counting that Attitude Era stuff in 98, 99, 2000, where there's a lot of crap there with, you know, the and some of it even literal crap with the dogs pooping around
right.
the Kennel in Hell match and all that, you know, and him getting hung on the symbol. Let's go back to 88. He, you know, comes in. He's this big, burly dude, 360, who's the monster opponent for Hogan and is one of Hogan's best house show opponents into early 89. And then eventually, you know, he's paired with Dusty and then has the babyface turn. And as that happens, he loses a ton of weight, maybe about 50 pounds. And now he's like this spry 310-pound guy who's chasing Mr. Perfect all over the ring at WrestleMania 7. So you had two really great distinct eras of, you know, his career. And you could even say three, depending on how much you like the Attitude era stuff. Where he's with the corporation is more of a garbage, hardcore-style wrestler there.
Good point. All right, I have Axe at 55, Jerry Lawler, King Kong Bundy, X-Pac, and AJ Styles. I thought really hard about 51 to 55 because I'm thinking these are the guys that are just missing the top 50. AJ Styles, I've watched a lot of his work the last year and a half since he's come in, and I just think he's unbelievable. He's maybe my favorite. When I watch wrestling in 2018, he's always seems to be the bright spot. King Kong Bundy is the main event, the first mass WrestleMania I watched. That I weighed that heavily. And I like Bundy. I love his smash at WrestleMania 3. I like his character work. He's another guy who's great in the shoot interview stuff, the kayfabe commentaries. King was tough for me to rank because so much is out of ring, but he did enough in ring and his stuff with Bret Hart. I didn't know where to rank him. I put him here. And, you know, Axe and Smash, you know, and Demolition, one of my favorite tag teams. And this is the other. I liked Axe. I always liked Axe a little bit better than Smash, so he's a little bit higher. But that's 55 to 51. What'd you think of those guys?
It's a shame with – when I actually transcribed your list, I actually wrote Bill Eadie instead of Axe because I wanted to make sure I did not forget about his – little mass superstar run
right.
in 83 and 84,
yeah.
which I feel like it was really kind of going somewhere, and then it got stunted around the springtime, and you don't see him again until he comes back as Super Machine in 86. I would actually give him a little bit of credit for being one of the machines because that was a fun little bit while it lasted, and of course Axe speaks for itself. This really nothing more I could add to that. For Lawler, he's another case of trying to separate Jerry Lawler from his work in Memphis is a really tall task. And, you know, in terms of just taking his stuff in ring, like you were saying, separating out the commentary, I think the Brett feud was really, really great in 93. It allowed Brett to have a good high profile feud while not being the champion. Because I mean, it was a bit of a downgrade for him as well. It did get a little silly in 95, but the King is always good at making the silly stuff work. And that kind of goes back to Memphis where there was a lot of silliness there as well. And I do have to mention that match in 94 at the Survivor Series with the with the minis against all that, it's one of my favorite comedy matches of all time. I don't know if it was that when I watched Survivor Series 94 a couple of months ago, whether I was in just a really good mood with Lawler selling the Burger King hat like it was the little crown, like it was the worst thing that had ever happened to him. It's like, is this the Flair Steamboat of comedy matches here? It's like this thing is 6.5 stars right now. Is Lawler the greatest comedy match worker ever? I think he's certainly in the conversation. And I also give him credit for that 97 Royal Rumble where he gets up off commentary,
yes.
gets into the ring. Bret Hart eliminates him with one punch. I love that bit. It's been overdone since then with lesser guys. But he did it first, and he did it better.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't the Bushwhacker do it first?
Well, the Bushwhacker did the march in and march out, which
I think is a little different.
I'm thinking more of of Bradshaw getting up and
walking
in and all that. And by the way, I did not include him on the omissions because I just don't like him.
Yeah, he's a jobber to me. Yeah, I don't know.
But back to the list here at 51, AJ Styles. I think that his 2016 is one of the best in-ring years by anybody in the history of the company.
And so it's, good. It's so good.
It's all there for anybody, you know, for any type of fan. I mean, you can't just not – you have to appreciate just how great he was. You take just that one calendar year, it really stands out. It's probably a top 25 year by anybody in the company. And that's all around, including – you know, promos. I probably couldn't name an AJ Styles promo offhand, but damn, like every match that he had, the Roman Reigns stuff, and in high profile spots. And on week to week, he was making SmackDown after the brand split some of the best television that WWE had in quite some time.
So that's the first 50 guys or the bottom 50 guys on my list. Let me ask you a couple questions that will make me curious. From 100 to 51, leaving out number 100, because we already kind of said that's kind of a vanity spot, who is the one guy you would boot off first? Who would be your first elimination to put someone else in?
Mr. T.
Fair. That's fair.
And here's why. Because he was very important for WrestleMania 1
and
in
two.
Terms of getting that to the level. I think, though, that his appearance in 2 was a bit of a flop because the crowd turned on him during that match, which I don't think that they were expecting that to happen because the Long Island crowd, you know, it's Greater New York market. You know, maybe they could be a little finicky, but to hear a heel get cheered the way Piper did at WrestleMania 2 is really stunning to watch.
My counterargument to that, though, will be they sold a lot of tickets. Because if you look at the attendance among the three buildings, it didn't do well at all in Chicago. It did fine in L.A. Obviously, they have Hogan. But it did pretty well in Long Island. And, I mean, he's the main event of that with Piper. So those two guys did sell a lot of tickets. I understand the match itself is obviously a flop. I mean, it was terrible. I'm not saying it wasn't. But
and the other thing to consider with T is he had that little run 87. In 87 where mm-hmm. he's the enforcer. And he's there for like July and August, and just kind of looking at his arc from WrestleMania 1, and then WrestleMania 2 doesn't go quite as well. You're getting diminishing returns, and also the A team is starting to peter out by 86 and 87, and then he comes in 87. And he's literally feuding with Danny Davis, so he goes from teaming with Hogan in the main event of WrestleMania to getting booed on Long Island is like because he wasn't appearing on the TV leading up to WrestleMania 2. And then you get into 87. He's literally feuding with Danny Davis before he departs in pretty short order. So he's the first guy that I probably would have booted out.
Who's the one guy in this group that you most likely would have ranked from 50 to 1, if anyone?
From all of 51 to 100?
Right.
This is going to sound weird because you had him closer to 100 than to 51, but probably Pat Patterson, just on the basis of seeing his work from 79 to 83. I don't think I would have had him, say, in the top 20. I think I would have had him somewhere in the 30s or 40s, but he's somebody that I've definitely grown to appreciate quite a bit and last couple of years as this footage is readily available on YouTube.
All right. With all that said, that's the first half of the list or the bottom half of the list. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to work our way to the announcement of number one.
Play Simulations, JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Pete Wentz and Steve Bennett back here. We are revealing my top 100 WWF/E wrestlers as part of the Place to Be Nation project. In the last segment, we went from number 100, the Haiti Kid, down to number 51, AJ Styles. And now we will get into the names, right? These are the guys as we go here. I would think there'll be a little bit more debate, a little bit more discussion in the sense that these 51 to 100, it's kind of like you're not as passionate either way, especially those bottom guys. It's like you could have argued me out of George Steele being on the list pretty easily for, like I said, probably 13 guys, you know, where now we're going to get down to, and I think we'll get a debate right off the top. So let's start at number 50. I have Vince McMahon, 49, Shane McMahon, the first WWF champ. At next, Sid next, and the Dynamite Kid at 46. I've listened to some podcasts for this project where people are talking about Vince as a top five guy, and I just don't see it. I know as a heel, his character work, it's unbelievable, but there's just, I mean, nothing there in ring at all. I mean, I can't think of one match I'd want to watch, I don't think. So I put
a good match with Shane at 17.
Right. So I did put Shane just ahead of him for his bumping, you know, and for the how much I respect a guy who doesn't have to take any of those bumps for taking so many of them for so many years. And I've enjoyed watching them. I like to watch this guy jump off of shit or get thrown into it or whatever. I put him ahead of his dad. But what about Vince as like a top 10 guy? Because I've heard that a lot. And I'm assuming he's going to get a lot of votes from 1 to 10 in this project, I think.
I really don't see it. I mean, when I say that was a great match with him and Shane at 17, that's really more it's more story than it is an actual match. I mean, it's a hardcore match. It's a product of its time is what it was. However, he gets probably equal demerit for the horrificness of the 1999 Royal Rumble match, one of my least favorite matches.
Awful.
All time. I just hate that match so much. And I also kind of punish him for the fact that he's a great heel, and nobody was better than him at what he was doing. However, he was so good at it, he created this horrible archetype that wrestling to this day in 2018 cannot shake, that of the heel authority figure. Think about it, okay? Wrestling went all the way up to 1996 and 97 without a heel authority figure. And that's pretty much what Eric Bischoff. Maybe there was in some of the smaller territories where you have you know, like these little, I guess, takeover angles, like in World Class in 89, stuff like that. But, you know, on a big stage. And we can't shake the damn authority when it comes to WWE because of how good Vince's character was. And nobody is ever going to live up to that.
Nope.
So they really need to move on. And good I don't know point. Why I'm punishing him for it, but I guess I just am. Now, Shane McMahon is a guy that you and I think we do not park our cars in the same garage on these two guys, on that guy, because when he came back in 2016, I remember when it happened because it was on a Raw in Detroit, and I was at a Bruins Oilers game, I want to say, and I find the thing on Twitter, and I was like, I wasn't expecting that to happen. I'm like, I wonder what Shane's going to do. And what he ended up doing was one of the worst storylines of all time, where I want to control Monday Night Raw. Okay, well, if you want Monday Night Raw, you're going to have to face The Undertaker. And that match is just so plodding and boring. It's 33 minutes of...
Way too long, for sure.
Waiting for him to jump off a cage, which, by the way, is completely reckless. And I don't give him that much credit for doing those types of things, because you're creating almost this expectation that other guys should do those spots. It's fairly reckless to be doing stuff like that.
Can I play devil's advocate there? I would just say no, because I look at that as that's what Shane does. Like, that's Shane's thing. So I'm never looking for another guy to be Shane, really.
That's true, although Mick Foley was...
Well, it was Mick's first. Sure, it was Mick's first. I'll give you that. But, you know, like, if I'm watching a card, like, if I'm watching that Mania card a couple years ago, Shane's the guy I'm looking to jump off the top of the cell. Like, I didn't leave that night thinking, well, why didn't anyone else do a death-defying stunt? Because to me, you know, it's Shane's thing, you know, so...
And just the more recent stuff where... I haven't watched SmackDown in a while, and part of the reason for that is the awful Shane McMahon character, where he's literally like now the only babyface on SmackDown, where and he conducts himself like a heel, because, you know, putting basically with some weird psychology, like having Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens in a handicap match, like, okay, so you're going to stack the odds against the heels here? That's really weird. It's funny how I'm trashing Shane McMahon so much, because usually I'd stick up for a fellow Boston University Terrier like Shane or Stephanie, but I'm not going to in this case. In fact, I disavow them completely from the Terrier family, just for some of the stuff that they've done over the years and some of the tropes they've perpetuated that are not helpful. On the other hand, we have Sid here, and first of all, I love that you put the Dynamite Kid and Sid back to back here, because I can't think of two guys who are quite so different in terms of in-ring work. Dynamite had some really good singles stuff in, I think it was 82 with the Cobra at MSG, that it's one of those matches that you can hear the crowd just kind of reacting in a way like they're blown away, because they're seeing stuff. This is 1982 WWF, and they're doing sort of more modern cruiserweight moves. It's kind of fun to watch the audience react to that. I can't vouch for any of Dynamite's backstage stuff and some of the things
that he
got
ribbing.
Into.
He's a mean ribbing.
Yeah. And the injury in 87, like, he needed to not be working, because, I mean, that harms him, obviously, to this day. Sid, I mean, I am, you know, I don't want to say that I'm a typical Northeastern wrestling fan, but when it comes to Sid, I pretty much am. And I don't know what it is about the Northeastern United States and Boston, New York, and Philly, but we all love us some Sid.
Yep.
And it's probably because we've never tried to book him and had him no show on us.
During softball season, right? That's the joke.
Yeah. Or even more recently with I can't go because of Donald Trump's travel ban and that stuff. It's a shame that he's so flaky, but it's also part of his charm over time that he's so flaky as well. So his character flaw kind of makes him lovable at the same time. And also, he was magnificent during the turn on Hogan in 92. I think maybe in the Rumble he conducted himself a little bit too much like a babyface in the post-match stuff. You know, when they were struggling to get the crowd to stop booing Hogan, he kept pointing at the guy who had the Hulk Who sign, which all right, Sid, let's take it easy here. You wanted to turn heel here and be in the main event of WrestleMania, but yet you're acting all babyface. You got Survivor Series 96 with Shawn, the New York crowd just going nuts for him. He's assaulting old men at ringside, and like nobody cares, and it's just wonderful. I mean,
an all-time great Sid moment is at that press conference that Jack Tunney is having to name the number one contender, and he like stands up because he's so sure it's going to be him, and he doesn't get named. They name Hogan, right?
Yeah.
So I thought that was really great.
Was bogus. The most bogus I've ever pulled up. But that's actually not even my favorite Sid thing from the time. It's definitely when he went on the barbershop and tore it all up. And everybody remembers that. But the best part is when he got like shaving cream and powder like all over his face. And then he goes to the camera and starts yelling menacingly as Sid would do. But he's got shaving cream all over his face. So it's hilarious and terrifying at the same time.
Number 45, the most criminally underrated guy, I think, on my list, Adrian Adonis.
Yep.
Then I have Edge, Razor Ramon, Jake the Snake Roberts, and the Honky Tonk Man, the man who broke my heart in 1987, at number 41. Another guy who I think is underrated because he was just so good at making us hate him that we hate him. But I almost even ranked him higher. But what about these five guys?
Did you put Razor and Edge back to back just because
of
their names?
Razor's Edge? No, I didn't, but that would have been good. I did put Honky Tonk Man and Roberts close together based on their history, sort of. Not really, but it worked out. You know, maybe I would have had Roberts one spot lower, but I moved him up to be next to him or something like that. But no. Yeah, Razor's Edge, that would have been a good one. I wish I would have thought of that. Damn it.
I was never really an Edge guy. It's like I might be the only person in the world whose favorite version of Edge was like the one who debuted in 98, who would just come out of the crowd every so often, like pre-Brood Edge. Like I look at Edge like an indie band before they signed with a label, and the second their songs start get played on the radio, I'm like, oh, I listen to them first. That's the way I kind of look at him, and I probably would have been unfair to him on a ballot. A guy who I'd be much more fair to is Adrian Adonis. He's a guy who, as a kid and as a teenager, looking back, it's like I never understood the adorable gimmick. I was like, why couldn't he just be the street tough guy from New York City like he always was? But the thing that I didn't get at that time was just the importance of outlandish characters. I mean, it wasn't that, you know, out of line with, you know, other characters who had come along in the past with sort of effeminate gimmicks. And I don't think he was being homophobic in any way either.
No.
Or
I didn't think so either.
I mean, they might have been preying on that a little bit too much.
Some jokes from the gorilla, some jokes maybe, but.
Yeah. Wrestling and homosexuality, that's a really kind of an interesting topic. I know that there's been podcasts on that in the past. I think Military Industrial Suplex has done a podcast on it about a year ago. And the way he made that work, and I had forgotten until about a year ago. I was watching Tuesday Night Titans. He said, "I'm gay" on a Tuesday Night Titans in, I think it was early 86. It was definitely before WrestleMania 2, but the way he could move around the ring for a guy who was just blowing up like a balloon.
Hey, bumps like an animal. This guy over some great bumps.
Going back to 82 when he'd come in for a little bit, didn't have more than a couple of matches with Backlund, but always an enjoyable watch there. As for Jake, he's a guy that I think would have been higher if it wasn't for some of his issues. He's somebody who his storylines are more memorable than his matches.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I didn't always love his matches, you know.
I mean, what's the greatest Jake Roberts WWF match? Just off the top of your head.
Well, I can't say the one where he hits Steamboat with the DDT because there's no match there. It's not his WrestleMania 4 match. That's terrible. It's not his WrestleMania 7 match.
And I'm not going to say Tuesday in Texas because most of that is the post-match angle.
You know, it might be his Honky Tonk Man match at WrestleMania 3, which I think is really underrated because it follows Steamboat.
Yeah, that it is a very good match in a very tough spot.
Right. I'm off the top of my head, I would say that. You know,
all involved there. I'm thinking his best one is November 86 Saturday Night's Main Event against Savage in a bizarre heel versus heel match.
Oh yeah, good call. That's a great
like
match.
A litmus test for those guys of like, yes. Okay, we're gonna take the temperature here. And the great thing about that match is how Ventura and Vince are surprised at the crowd going for Jake instead of Savage there in that IC title match. And speaking of the IC title, the Honky Tonk Man, a guy who was certainly my father's favorite wrestler just based on gimmick alone. He'd always tell me that he was the greatest champion of all time, just as Honky would say on TV, because he held it longer than anybody else, although it was really not that much longer than Macho Man.
Savage, yeah, just barely, yeah.
Only by a few days, but he's just the perfect example of superlative character work and also being in the right place at the absolute right time. If he's that character 6 months before or 6 months later or 2 years later or 2 years before that, I don't think he gets that break where he gets the IC title and headlines B shows for a while and, you know, becomes a bankable star into 88 before it just kind of, you know, fades out after, you know, because everything runs its course. Everything ends badly. Otherwise, it wouldn't end. And so it was for the Honky Tonk Man's little run there.
Should I tell my Honky Tonk Man story?
Oh, go ahead.
So I mentioned I started watching right around 86. The Steamboat Savage angle is just, it hit me right at the right time. I mean, I thought there was a chance that Savage was going to kill Steamboat. And, you know, I remember telling my grandpa about it, and he was really old at the time. It's like one of the few memories I have of my grandpa is, like, tell him about this. And, you know, I just love this, and I follow the whole thing. The doctor, you know, he's got – Jesse's saying he's got a lot of throat. Just everything about it, I just love it. And I have this big party for WrestleMania 3 at my house. All my friends from school are there. I mean, I'm not quite 7 years old yet. I'm six-ish, going on seven. And the worst thing happened at my party. The pizza came right before the Steamboat Savage match. Well, I was not going to leave to watch to miss that match, but my friends didn't really care that much. They wanted pizza. So I was like the only one in the room watching this match that just changed my life as a wrestling fan. As a six-year-old, like, I'd never be the same again. You know, I was only six, but anything that happened before didn't matter anymore to me. No. So my dad takes me to a TV taping just a couple months later in Buffalo, New York. And as the Honky Tonk Man is introduced, and I don't remember if I knew that Steamboat was defending against him, but obviously the Fink says that the next match is for the Intercontinental Championship. So as Honky Tonk's coming to the ring, I remember telling my dad, like, this guy sucks. He's got no chance. He's not going to beat Steamboat. You know, this is the perfect match because he's just not going to beat him. And then, of course, he does, and it happened basically right in front of me. I was right on that side of the ring. And, yeah, I mean, I cried on my dad's lap for 45 minutes. I mean, I was devastated. And after a while, my dad took me out into the concourse of the auditorium, and he bought me nachos and one of those Hulk Rules foam fingers. And, I mean, he tried everything to get me back, but I was just in devastation. And then Hogan finally came out, and that ended badly, too, because he got green mist squirted in his face. So yeah, it's a rough day. All right. Yeah. Number 40, Ravishing Rick Rude, British Bulldog, Paul Orndorff, Superstar Billy Graham, and Kevin Nash at 36. Rude, I will say, I was considering him in that Roberts Honky Tonk Man Razor Ramon right in there, but I gave him the edge just because he was the guy who could get the best matches out of the Warrior. So I gave him a boost for that. Bulldog is another guy who maybe is a little bit higher on my list than most. Same with Orndorff. Graham, of course, maybe a little bit of a guy who could have even been higher if it would have worked out right for him. And then Nash at 36. What about these five?
Rude is such a weird guy just in general because of his whole shtick, both here and in other places where he couldn't work with Hogan. He couldn't work with Flair. There's a match with Hogan in January of 88. So Hogan is still the champion, and it's at the Boston Garden where he hits Hogan in the head with a chair, but hits him like with the pointy part of one of those wooden chairs, which seemed like a stupid thing to do. And then you don't see a single Hogan Rude match after that point. Like, I wonder why Hogan doesn't want to face Rude anymore after just the most unsafe chair shot. He didn't even fold up the chair either. He like hit him with the seat part, the point of it. I do wish that I'd seen more of some of Rude's 89, like the Piper feud, which is primarily on house shows. You see them in the ring together at Survivor Series 89, but they don't have a one-on-one match on pay-per-view, which is kind of a shame. You're right, though. He did get more out of Ultimate Warrior than anybody else. They had some sort of bizarre chemistry, probably dating back to the World Class even, because I remember them in World Class in 86, it must have been, where they're in the ring together. British Bulldog, he's just, probably in about the right spot. He had a 5-star match, even though he was kind of
dragged
up
around.
Yeah. To it.
Yeah.
He was there.
Yeah,
he was there for it. Graham, all you can say is that he was so far ahead of his time, and it's a shame that he broke down the way that it did. I mean, there's been so much said about that. Orndorff at 38, I don't think you have him too high at all.
Oh, okay, good.
He's the thing I like about him is he's incredibly versatile in that you could use him as your top heel, second from the top heel, third from the top heel, but he could also be your second from the top baby face and third for the top baby face. He did flounder a bit during that baby face period. I mean, WrestleMania 2, he's in there with Morocco in a, 5-minute double count out because they're rushing through things.
It's too bad that match wasn't on later in the card when they weren't rushing. You know, that could have been so much better.
Yeah, they were just kind of circling the airport, waiting for to time out the Hogan turn at that point, because they really only made him babyface so they could then turn him back again. I also think that Orndorff might be the greatest WWE wrestler who never held a title of any kind that's on this list, and I'm looking at the guys coming up on this list, excluding a couple that you have here. Every single one of them held a title of some kind, but Orndorff was never in a tag team there, at least beyond the pairing with Piper. I mean, he was still very much a singles wrestler, but also he's a great Hogan opponent too, because he's not this plodding 400-pound muscle guy. He's a guy who's kind of on equal footing. He's not as tall as Hogan, and he doesn't have as big arms as Hogan, but he's right there with him, and he's believable in that spot. And some of his promos are a little off kilter. There's something a little off and dangerous about him, but I like that. That's good to have.
Number 35 is where I put the Ultimate Warrior. He was another guy who's really hard to rank. Iron Sheik, Yokozuna, Randy Orton, I know a polarizing guy for you, and Sergeant Slaughter at 31. And there's going to be a lot to talk about, I assume, in this group here.
Yeah, this is the when I was looking at the list, I said this is the WWF champion nexus here, because all of them have had runs as the top guy with varying degrees of success. I mean, obviously Iron Sheik is there to get it from one guy to another, But the character of the Iranian coming in sets up Hogan beautifully, and then he works his way into the Sergeant Slaughter program, who I'm going to have a lot more to say about in just a second. In terms of the Warrior, you have to rank him somewhere on anybody's list simply because of the way he starts out as a guy who's working nothing C shows in June of 87, debuting in Wichita Falls, Kansas, before 600 people. And then within 3 years, he's main eventing against Hulk Hogan in WrestleMania. So you have to respect that, no matter what you might think of the character, his in-ring work, or whatever. Yokozuna, I'm always kind of I never quite know what to make of him. I think he's certainly believable as the top guy in 1993, and certainly kind of a placeholder sort of thing, because you know Hogan is not in the picture anymore. He's dispatched him. You don't want Brett as the top guy at that point, and you're keeping Lex Luger away from that top spot. I never quite know what to make of him, because once he loses the title, they don't really seem to want to do anything with him as a singles guy anymore. And I don't quite.
Well, was his weight just such an issue then? Is that
Yeah,
I think that's why they got him in the tags. Yeah.
So Orton, he is what he is. He's a perfectly cromulent wrestler, but he's never exactly made me, you know, say, oh, geez, a Randy Orton match. I better put that one on.
You know what I'll say about Orton real quick? To jump in. I think if you wanted to ask me what a wrestler should look like, that's what I would make him look like. You know what I mean? Like,
I would give him better shoulder joints, though.
Better, right? Yeah, they haven't always held up. Yeah, but he looks the part, and you know, I think he just lacks a little bit of charisma. But, you know, he can come off as boring sometimes, maybe, and maybe even his matches sometimes can be boring. But his Rollins WrestleMania match is great. And the finish is great.
31. Yeah, that is one of the high points of that particular show. But at number 31, speaking of number 31, you have Sergeant Slaughter, who I group with Pat Patterson in the more you watch of him, the more that you can see his greatness, because people think of the Iraqi traitor Slaughter in 90 and 91 and kind of roll their eyes and how tasteless the whole sort of deal was with him and all that. But even then, he had some really good Desert Storm matches in the summer of 91 with Hulk Hogan. But what I'm saying is, the more you watch of him in 80 and 81 when he has his first run, and then in 83 when he comes back as a heel after it being in the Carolinas for a while, and the way that they turn him in 84 was just perfect, using the Iron Sheik again as a foil, and also perfectly timed too, to kind of coincide with certain, I don't know, Reaganism in 84. I mean, whatever your politics might be, it was kind of in touch with the mood of the country to have Sergeant Slaughter in that spot. And he's getting reactions pretty close to the level of Hulk Hogan on 1984 television. And he's there all the time. He has great matches with Sheik. Boot camp matches. There's the original match on TV as well. But go back to his heel work in 80 and 81, his matches with him and Andre. He's one of Bob Backlund's very best opponents that he ever had. And of course, the Pat Patterson alley fight, both the one in Madison Square Garden and at the Philadelphia Spectrum as well. It's really a guy who, the more you watch of him, the more you will appreciate him.
He was hard to rank. I almost wanted to put him higher, but man, what a talent. I wish he could have been around. You know, I wish Vince would have just said, all right, fine, take your G.I. Joe character, you know, or whatever their beef was.
I think he was also getting burned out by the schedule, because in late 84, the WWF schedule was, because they hadn't quite figured out how to route guys properly, where you go from this town to the next. They would just kind of haphazardly, like, oh, tonight we're in Detroit and tomorrow you're going to be in Vancouver, and then the next night you're going to be in Denver, and then after that you'll be in Washington DC. It's like they hadn't quite figured out how to loop guys on a national basis yet, and I think Slaughter got kind of sick of that and said, if I can make good money just being a G.I. Joe character, why don't I just do that? So I don't blame him one bit for doing what he did.
Absolutely. At number 30, I have Jeff Hardy, another guy hard to rank. Next, Ric Flair, Ted DiBiase, Owen Hart, and at number 26, Daniel Bryan. What do you think about these five?
Hardy, he always strikes me as just too much of a stunt guy.
Just so over, though. He's just so over. I mean, he's arguably the biggest guy they have for a couple years.
That ladder match with Undertaker is certainly one of the great Raw matches ever. What's the Jim Ross line? Go make yourself famous, kid.
Yep.
Going for the belt. I think a lot of it is the just kind of his personal issues color my view of him.
Fair.
A
that's
little
fair.
Bit.
Yep. That's fair.
Ric Flair.
Let's be fair to Flair here.
I will be extremely fair to Flair because if you just 92 Royal Rumble match is my favorite match of all time, and of course that is the This Is Your Life starring Ric Flair as everybody from his past and future come through the ring at some point, and he's there literally for the entire time and interacts with everybody in the match, including DiBiase gets eliminated before him, but they pass each other as DiBiase's leaving and Flair is coming to the ring. And DiBiase at 28 is so important in that Hogan-Andre dynamic and help make that fresh by having the buy the belt angle. And it got them a way out of having Andre win the belt outright. Because if you have Andre win the belt, you're going to have him lose it at some point back, and you don't want him to lose it right back to Hogan because Hogan's going to go make a movie. So his role there, and how I said they always had something interesting for DiBiase to do, and part of that is the character, but also it's the fact that he was so good at just about all the elements you want from a pro wrestler. He's a good promo. He's very good in ring. All of his mannerisms are just top notch. You could say the same for Owen Hart, I guess, wasn't the greatest promo in the world, although as kind of the annoying younger brother heel, I always wondered if you could have flipped it and made Owen the babyface fighting uphill against heel Brett, but that would have been bad to turn Brett heel at that point because he was just too popular in Europe. The way that they did it was correct, but Owen Hart was about as good as it got in the mid to late 90s, and some of those like 98 early 99 shows, and Owen Hart's on there. It's like, oh, good. This is what wrestling can be here. Like, we have an actual professional wrestler instead of just a brawler or whatever.
Underrated match against Mr. Perfect at WrestleMania 5, too, just because it's not long enough, probably. But
yeah, they got about
minutes?
7 minutes.
Six, yeah.
It's something that you wish that he could have gotten a little bit more of a break as the Blue Blazer in the late 80s there, where the crowds, I think, were reacting to him, but they weren't going to let him really talk or anything like that. And then Daniel Bryan, he's a guy that I missed most of his run. Like, I had started watching again sort of, as he's in the midst of the whole battle with the Authority shortly after the 2014 Royal Rumble and
WrestleMania 30 was the first WrestleMania on the network. So I had obviously gotten the network when it debuted, hoping for all the other things other than the newer things. So I had some friends over to watch 30 that really wanted to watch it, didn't have the network. And I mean, I couldn't believe there was a guy on the roster getting the reaction he got that night. I mean, his night in New Orleans, WrestleMania 30, I mean, it's almost as good of a night as anyone has ever had at the Superdome, other than like Drew Brees and Sean Payton for the NFC Championship game in 2009 or 2010 when it was played. But like, wow, what a night. Just, man, what a moment. It's almost like if I only seen him that night, I think I'd still put him 26. You know, like it was just so overwhelming to watch that.
And when I see, you know, Daniel Bryan and Owen Hart here back to back, I kind of see them both as sort of tragic figures because, yeah, you know, Owen obviously the most tragic of all, but Daniel Bryan, just how, you know, he had that ladder and then eventually he reaches the peak and then he's hurt and then he's out for almost a year and then he comes back and you have the big moment at WrestleMania 31 as the IC champion. So he's not, you think, okay, he's down a level there, but he's okay. So he's the IC champ. He's going to restore luster to that belt.
And that was the plan, right? They put him for IC and Cena for US. And we've seen what Cena did with US with the Monday Night Challenges and things. And they had a similar plan for Bryan to elevate that title. You know,
and so I think that they were going to do it where he would work on SmackDown and do a similar sort of thing. He kind of make, I guess, SmackDown more of the quote unquote wrestling show
to make that
a destination, even though it was still being taped at that time. But say this for Daniel Bryan, though, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, he never got opportunity. I mean, he eventually got there, but he had matches at five consecutive WrestleManias that were title matches, and they were all for different titles. So 31, he was the IC. 30 was for the world title. 29, I believe that was the tag titles, I want to say. And then 28, it was the U.S. title.
Very good.
And, oh, no, 28 was the World Heavyweight Championship because that was the infamous Sheamus 12 seconds or whatever it was, piece of business. And then before that, you had the U.S. title at 27, which I think was actually on a pre-show. Unfortunately. So he had five matches for five different titles at five consecutive WrestleManias. So
that's very cool.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Number 25, my all-time favorite, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Guerrero, who I think will probably be higher on other people's lists. Mr. Perfect. And then at 22, Gorilla Monsoon. And 21, the late, great Bobby the Brain Heenan. What about these five guys?
My first note about all of these is I think you might be the high vote on Gorilla.
Probably.
Simply because, you know, his most famous moment used to be in the intro of Championship Wrestling where he gets Muhammad Ali up in the airplane spin back in 76 when they were building to the Ali Inoki closed circuit thing there. I'm surprised you didn't have Steamboat higher, seeing as though he is one of your favorites. But
well,
that probably hurt him, right?
That probably hurt him in the list because I was always afraid I was using too much personal bias when I would rank him. I think I had him written down in like four different spots, you know. So I think probably if he was just a guy I liked more, he might have been, didn't like as much. He might have been higher, but I think I kept being self-conscious about where I put him.
So he's there from March of 85, and you go up to when he takes the time off and has to lose the IC title. It's a period of about 2.5 years there. So, you know, a decent enough run for the time period. I do think you probably have him at about the right spot.
I thought that was the right spot.
If you're looking to be objective there, I think you hit on that. Eddie Guerrero is a guy who, when I got the network, I took time to actually watch some of his 03 to 05 stuff, just because, you know, it's a period that I missed a great deal of. And with this being a WWF only list, obviously, I mean, what more can you say about him? I love that WrestleMania 20 match with Kurt Angle and the way they set up the story with the boot and all that. It's a very, very creative finish, I thought. Perfect there. I always think of his run as being cut short, and there was all sorts of fits and starts after he had that injury because he never really came back and had any sort of extended run. I mean, I guess you could count, what, 93?
93,
when,
yeah.
when he comes back, takes Warrior's place with Savage at Survivor Series 92. He never really got on track. I mean, the match at SummerSlam 93 with Michaels was disappointing, but his peak to me is definitely when he actually did get the IC title in 90. I do think it was a nice run, albeit interrupted by the weird Texas tornado rain from the second half of 1990 that I didn't think was particularly necessary.
I give his match with Brett at 91 SummerSlam 5 stars. My all-time favorite SummerSlam match.
I remember watching that live as it happened, and I was just being so excited about that match as it was happening, because you could see early in the match, Perfect had went to walk away. And I mean, he's debilitated by a back injury in that match, which I obviously did not know at the time. And Brett goes to grab him and he tears that singlet. So then he wrestles the rest of the match with like kind of one singlet up on, you know, one strap up on his shoulder. And it kind of looks like he looks like the battered champion, just trying to hang on in vain. And then, you know, loses by Brett just reversing a random hold to where he's dropping a leg on Brett's groin, which I thought was a little weird looking, but it worked very nicely into the finish there. And Heenan at 21, you know, Heenan had more in-ring stuff than people care to remember.
Over 100 matches. 120-something matches, I think.
I mean, I know when I first started watching YouTube wrestling matches, God, like 3-4 years ago, I watched that Heenan-Sal Palomo match from MSG in 84, and it was, I think, the second MSG show that Heenan was there for. I think it was probably October. And just wow, he beat Palomo, who was, you know, not a jobber, but, you know, probably next level up there, and he's a manager. And I do think that even though being a manager isn't necessarily part of the criteria here, just, you know, the act of managing, the way he would bump, the way he would do that over the corner turnbuckle thing and just fly out of the ring like a gymnast, it was just amazing the way he could do that. And it's a shame he couldn't manage any longer after 91, but obviously his commentary work at the 92 Rumble will be celebrated forever.
Yeah, it's a huge shame that he didn't have his voice when the podcast era started, because he would have had the best podcast.
Yeah.
Number 20, we're getting into the cream of the crop here, sort of. At number 20, we have Greg the Hammer Valentine. 19, his counterpart, Tito Santana. Chris Jericho, Kurt Angle, and another polarizing guy at 16, Triple H. What about these five guys?
Well, I'm glad you had Tito and Valentine next to each other here.
Had to be next to each other. Had to be.
They are just forever linked. One of the great feuds of the 80s, those two guys. When they pass away, I hope that they're buried next to each other so that they can continue this into the afterlife, because I don't know if they were the best opponents for each other, but you can't go wrong looking up a Tito versus Valentine match, whether it's 84, 85, even 88. They threw them together on primetime for a match because neither guy had anything to do. It was always something that they could sort of go back to there. And I think you have those two guys. You know, it takes Valentine a little bit of time to warm up, which was obviously his weakness. Take the Hammer 15 minutes to get warmed up in a match, even though WWF matches would
never
rarely
had a match
ever
that
last
long.
15 minutes. It's like, and also to Valentine's credit, and I guess Tito as well, both very good tag team workers as well. And Valentine carried the Dream Team. We're not going to discuss the new Dream Team, but the one with Cake during the tag title reign. And Tito with Martel and Strikeforce, much better fit than Zenk was in the Can-Am Connection.
Even though Jericho, Tito was a looser.
his timing was way off.
Yeah, he was a looser.
Jericho at 18, obviously still active, I guess, even though
the list thing was great. Like, he had a great year with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, still doing good work.
Yeah. I mean, Wrestle Kingdom with Kenny Omega, which, like, did that get eight and a quarter stars?
I still haven't found out. I was going to ask you if you knew how many stars Meltzer gave it. I don't know.
The way he's able to reinvent himself over time is obviously his greatest strength. He puts a lot of care into what his character was. And I proclaimed him dead in 2014 when he had that run with Bray Wyatt. I said, well, this is clearly the end of Chris Jericho. There's nothing left but really it was a function of him being across the ring from Bray Wyatt, who quite frankly, isn't that good.
No.
Kurt Angle was another guy. I had said Eddie Guerrero. I went back and watched a lot of the matches. There was a period, I don't know when, it was probably 2015, where I just decided to have Kurt Angle week, where I would watch two Kurt Angle matches before work each day and just kind of write about them for the message board that I was posting on at that time. And I'm not sure he's appreciated enough. I think there's a lot of silliness maybe in his stuff, but I appreciate silliness and goofiness in wrestling now than I did when I was a humorless teenager who just wanted to see guys wrestle or whatever. I appreciate him way more now than I did. I don't think he should be let anywhere near a ring as a wrestler just for his own safety and for the safety of everybody else, because too much has happened to his body that it would be horrible if something happened to him at this point now. And Triple H, he is
it's not necessarily my favorite, but like, how do you rank him much lower than that? I mean, what name something he hasn't done? He's done everything.
That is true. He never won the Cruiserweight Championship.
Yeah, that's about it.
I'm surprised, because didn't he say that he was pushed as a cruiserweight in WCW when they did the Cruiserweight tournament a couple of years ago? It was like some nonsensical offhanded thing. I find it very hard to separate out executive Triple H from just pure wrestler Triple H. There's just so much damage that, like, or maybe it's perceived damage from his run as the top guy in the mid-2000s. It's just somebody I didn't want to see. In terms of his in-ring style, I don't really have as much of a problem with, you know, the slow, methodical Harley Race stuff.
Yeah, I don't mind him in the ring.
His match with Daniel Bryan at 30 is
it's great.
Really, really good.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, when I watched WrestleMania 30 live, I missed the Bryan Triple H match, and I had to go back and watch it later. I missed it because I was coming home from curling. So oh. I know that's such a cliche.
Are you a sweeper, or are you the other spot?
Well, at that point, I was just in this Sunday Night League where we would rotate through, and I always liked being the number two guy, because you got a lot of sweeping time. And you didn't have to be the guy who was just throwing guards the entire
right.
How many people will actually get these curling?
Very few.
They're listening to this.
Watch curling
during the Olympics, everybody. Trust me, you're gonna like it.
Oh, it's fascinating. Can't look away. All right, we'll do one more group, and then we'll go one by one for the top 10. 15, I had CM Punk. 14, Backlund. 13, Undertaker. 12, Mick Foley. And number 11, Andre the Giant.
Punk is a guy who I like the idea of CM Punk more than what he actually is in practice. I like him that he's this iconoclastic guy who doesn't necessarily always run with the traffic in everything that he does. I think that that's great and made him a unique and memorable character. I think that the fact that he takes that a bit too far and doesn't kind of go with the program hurt him.
I bet he's number one on a lot of lists.
Yeah, you know, I would not surprise me to see him finish in the top 10 overall. as the votes are still being tabulated. But, you know, I like the idea of him more than in practice. He's a guy that I have not necessarily seen his entire body of work. The match with Cena at Money in the Bank is obviously that's the one everybody talks about the most because it led into the most famous storyline for Punk, which didn't necessarily end well for him that summer.
And Meltzer gave it five stars to that match.
Yep. And you got the match with Brock at SummerSlam 2013, which is another beauty of, you know, fighting the big monster and trying to overcome it and just, you know, coming up short in the end there. Now, Backlund is another guy, and I seem to be a broken record with the Vince Sr. guys, but you have to watch him.
Yep.
In ring. And there are criticisms about Backlund that he didn't give enough to his opponents. And there's one particular match with Stan Hansen, who I might have ranked on my list, and obviously he's not going to be in your top 10. Backlund kind of was teaching Hansen a lesson at the urging of certain executives who were not thrilled with Stan Hansen's attitude. And Backlund's run, I mean, you don't get to be champion for that long without drawing crowds where it counts, like at Madison Square Garden. And that's that was, you know, Backlund was king there during that period. And yeah, it did peter out in 82 and 83, but like I said earlier, everything ends badly. Otherwise, it wouldn't end. The Undertaker, speaking of things ending badly, the less I think about the last couple of WrestleMania matches, the better with him. But he's a guy who is certainly going to – I don't think – I wonder what the low vote on the Undertaker ultimately will end up being.
It's got to be in everyone's top 20, right? I mean, is that
I can't imagine that anybody would have him below even 50. Even somebody who was so offended by the notion of the biker taker from 2000 to 2003 that they would just leave him off entirely or something like that. I mean, you know, he is what it is. And I see that you have his greatest foil in the promotion, Mick Foley, ahead of him at number 12. And I thought that was interesting. What was your reasoning behind Foley just ahead of Undertaker there?
Because he's the guy flying off the cage instead of the guy pushing him off the cage.
That's true, but shouldn't something be said?
That was the tiebreaker. I looked at him as a tie, and I gave that the tiebreaker.
Maybe I'm just valuing longevity a little bit more, but Foley, he's there, 96, and he's pretty much done as an active in-ring guy at the beginning of 2000. So you have a... you have roughly a four-year run there, and with Undertaker, you have a run of a quarter of a century.
That's a fair point. It's a fair point.
A little too much to overcome, even though the last, you know, 10 years or so, Undertaker, not exactly, you know, on weekly television or anything of that sort. And Andre, you know, until you get to 84, he's just kind of this weapon that Vince Sr. would loan out to other territories, who would float into New York and take care of whatever business he has. The thing with Hulk Hogan at Shea Stadium and a couple of other things. Well, you got the Killer Khan thing in 81 as well with the injury angle. And everybody, you know, thinks of decrepit Andre at the end. But you have to consider what he meant to the promotion as a whole and just how unbelievably popular he was. They don't draw the crowd in the Silver Dome without Andre.
Yeah, he's Andre the Giant. I mean, he is Andre the Giant.
And he's another guy that I'm very interested to see how he appears on some ballots, like who the low vote on him might be. I think some of the people who would prioritize quote-unquote work rate overall would probably not rank Andre high, but you got to look at the full big picture here and just what Andre meant to the promotion easily makes him a top 20 guy, and having him at number 11 to me makes sense. I might have had him maybe top 10 just out of respect, but 11 I think is a good spot for him.
All right, before we get into the top 10, who is my most overranked guy from 11 to 100?
Hmm. Overranked guy from 11 to 100. I did allude to it when we were just talking about it. I'm going to say Gorilla Monsoon there.
Okay.
At 22.
Who is my guy who you think I will have higher than everyone, but appropriately so in my favor?
Hmm. The high vote, but you would be, it would be appropriate. That's tough to say. I don't know if you'd be the high vote on any of these, save for at least for the ones that we've gone through so far. It's entirely possible you might be the high vote on superstar Billy Graham at 37, but I think that there are also people who would say this is one of the greatest promos in the history of wrestling, and just the sheer charisma and the fact that Hulk Hogan ripped off a lot of Graham's sort of oeuvre for his own big run, and that should count towards Graham's favor. So having him at 37 might be a high vote there. Buddy Rogers at 48, he's somebody who's so hard to rank because you can't really see any footage of him. He's tagging with Snuka in 82 and 83 in some matches that are on tape there. But it's kind of hard to say. You might actually be the high vote on Jim Neidhart at 59. That actually might be the one there, I think. But, you know, like I said, I don't think I was entirely out of line because different voters are going to value different things. And as you said, you're a tag team guy, so you're going to value Neidhart's undeniable contribution to the Hart Foundation team with Brett.
You had said to me that there was a guy I didn't rank you would have in the top 25. It's time to reveal that guy.
That would be Cesaro.
Okay.
Because
did you mention that? Was that off air or on air? I'm sorry.
I don't know if it was off air or on air, but if this allows me the chance to gush about Cesaro, because I never get to talk about him on my own podcast where I'm 20, 30 years in the past. this guy single-handedly brought me back to watching wrestling. Pretty much it was, and I remember when it was the Raw in Denver. I want to say it was February 2014, and it was right at the beginning of the Cena versus Cesaro match. And I had read a little bit about Cesaro from David Shoemaker writing on Grantland, I think it was at that time, about Cesaro and the giant swing and how he brought that move back. And I was watching all the athletic stuff that he could do. And I would have him ranked in the top 25 just on in-ring work alone. I think his promos have gotten a little bit better over time. Once he gets something to latch onto, I think he does a lot better with that. He had the Zeb Coulter mouthpiece with Swagger in the Real Americans, so he didn't really have to talk there. But with Your 99, Tyson Kidd, and when they were doing the clap clap fact thing, and now doing the bar with Sheamus and kind of the mutual respect and how that team ended up forming, because his matches with Sheamus were really, really good as well. But he's, I think, the best tag guy that they've had in the last 4 years since I've started watching again. And I just can't get enough. I talk on my podcast a lot about time traveling guys, like how I want 1998 New Jack to travel back in time and face Dr. D. David Schultz to find out who the greatest bounty hunter of all time is. Cesaro is a guy that I want him to travel all through time. Like, I want him facing Bruno in 1970 as like ethnic strongman versus ethnic strongman match. Have him go through all the various territories in the 70s and 80s, because I just see him fitting in seamlessly with like his athletic ability, maybe not so strong with the promos, but back then you could have pair a manager with him. You have to put him as a heel, but I think perhaps he could even get over on just in-ring work alone as a babyface. Also, the fact that he would be a time traveler as well. Maybe he'd be working a New Breed gimmick in Mid-South 1981. That would be something. But yeah, I love Cesaro. He's just fantastic.
You're making me feel bad for not ranking him. All right, let's do this. The top 10. All right, number 10. I believe he's the only person in my top 10 to win an NCAA championship. Brock Lesnar.
Well, but you said NCAA championship. You didn't specify what kind of NCAA championship.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
What am I missing?
Well, we'll get to him in a couple of spots from now.
Oh, I know what I'm missing. You're right. No, he's one of two. One of two.
So Lesnar, I go back and forth on him because when count me in the people who had no problem with him beating The Undertaker at 30. I think it was the right time to do it with the right guy.
I thought it was a cool moment.
And obviously the idea then was to build up Brock to be this monster
and
who would conquer Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam 2014. Bryan gets hurt, so then you sub in Cena and you have that shocking
squash
match.
Yeah.
Squash is Cena. I mean,
yep.
Really good.
Really well booked.
And that WrestleMania 31 match with Roman Reigns is quite a gem, those two guys, until it got ruined with that cockamamie, just atrocious, that horrible Money in the Bank nonsense of a finish there, which helped absolutely nobody. And
at least it saved Vince from the embarrassment of having Reigns beat Brock there.
Yeah, although you could have just had Brock retain since you had just re-signed him and said, all right, Brock, go take a couple of months off here, because that's what they were doing anyway. And when he first got the title, at least in this run, a WWE title in 2014 at that SummerSlam, I thought, okay, they'll do the rematch with Cena. But you're not going to see him for long periods of time. Now, the gap in logic there is you strip Daniel Bryan because he's going to be out for a while, but you let Lesnar literally sit on the sidelines for 4 months. Without defending or even really appearing on TV. But that also made his matches special when they would happen. Like the Rumble 15, as I said, WrestleMania 31. When Brock would have these matches, they would become special. Now, when Undertaker comes back and they have that SummerSlam 2015 match, that's where things start to peter out, because Brock had this aura about him. And him losing by submission to The Undertaker at that point in time really kind of harmed his aura with me.
You didn't think they protected him enough with The Undertaker tapping out and all that?
No, I thought that was a really dumb finish to do. And
well, I thought it was a dumb finish, but I think that they did protect him.
He had already won the match.
I mean, he won the match.
But there was a huge rub waiting there for the person who would beat the guy who beat The Undertaker. And it needed not to be The Undertaker getting that win back over Lesnar.
No, remember, I agree that the decision to have Undertaker win was bad. I just didn't think it hurt. I didn't think it hurt Brock as much, because to me he had a visual victory already. He won the match. The Undertaker tapped out.
But I think it also damages the rub you would get by anybody beating Brock.
No, that's true.
Later on. Even if it wasn't necessarily clean, I think when you have somebody beat Brock, which I'm trying to remember, has anybody beaten him other than Goldberg? And that's a whole other ball of wax there. You have Goldberg and Lesnar.
I think that's it, just Goldberg.
But Lesnar, in some of his more recent matches, just looks really blown up and out of gas very early on. He's had to make his matches shorter, which
turns
is fine.
Purple. Turns purple, like, Brock.
There is this notion that all main events have to be 24 minutes and have to be a certain way. No, they don't.
Right.
They could just be 6 minute sprints there. The Brock versus Goldberg match at WrestleMania 33 is actually pretty good because of how short they kept it.
Yeah, really good. I thought that whole thing was, I mean, if you're going to do it, I thought they booked it well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're
he's running out of gas in his matches, and it leads to things like the match with Strowman last summer where the finish just kind of comes out of nowhere with like almost no buildup. It's like, okay, that's all there is to it. But he still kind of is a special thing. I think he kind of he does get helped by having a mouthpiece, which for some reason hardly anybody else gets to have. I don't quite understand that. And I do wish that some of the mainstream types would stop kissing Heyman's ass for cutting the same promo for four straight years, just changing a few words here and there. But, yeah, Brock, you know.
Let me ask you this.
I haven't even talked about his 2002, 2003 stuff.
Right. Let me ask you this. Would Brock be in your top 10?
Probably not, but he would probably be in the next 10.
Okay. Let's keep it moving. Number 9. Shawn Michaels. So now this is the guy you hate. So go ahead, give it to me. Why do you? What's wrong with HBK?
All right. So, well, he's the guy who kind of made wrestling less about, you know, more about having a good match rather than characters fighting to win a championship or whatever. Like, no, the idea is not to have a good match. It's you're a character who is striving towards a goal or striving towards revenge against your opponent, or you know, something like that. Literally my comment here, and you know, I didn't comment on every single wrestler when I put your list in a spreadsheet here, but I commented for everyone in the top 10. For HBK, all I wrote was meh, he's fine. And you know, some people are Brett guys and some people are Shawn Michaels guys, and I'm a Brett guy, although I'm actually much less of a Brett guy than I was several years ago, because I find that Hitman seems to be a little bit humorless about
elements
of wrestling.
Takes himself very seriously. We'll get to him.
Well, like, okay, so Shawn Michaels in the Rockers, very good tag team. Rockers are the best WWF, WWE tag team ever that did not win a title of any kind
that counted.
I guess they did, but you know, phantom fashion there. As a single, I think his 93, he has the match where he's carrying Jannetty through it. I think that's Royal Rumble. But a lot of the stuff later in the year is disappointing before, you know, he disappears and comes back in 94. The ladder match with Razor I consider to be the second best match on WrestleMania 10. I'm pretty sure you can guess which
absolutely
is the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
He hosted one of the worst talk show segments ever, the Heartbreak Hotel, which it's not that hard to host a decent talk segment, and it just didn't connect with me, and that seems to be the crux of the whole character. Maybe it's the character that I just don't like so much. When you get into the heel 97, Shawn Michaels is doing some really strong stuff, even if he's kind of pushing the line of what you should be doing with your opponent in terms of maybe burying them too much, if you get what I'm saying there.
And maybe causing some riots at a couple of house shows, if you believe the rumors.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a problem. But I also think he was so kind of obnoxious and drugged up at the time that, you know, he wasn't exactly doing conventional things. Although it was working slowly but surely, it wasn't turning things around, you know, overnight in the WWF from the ratings perspective. And then the best thing that ever happened to the promotion was him getting hurt and not being there after WrestleMania 14.
Sure.
Because he would have been in the way from that point forward, because it needed the light needed to be on Austin 100%. And if Shawn Michaels is still there and he's pissing and moaning about every last thing, which had been basically his entire career up to that point, then the Austin phenomenon doesn't become all that it was going to become. And don't even forget another guy who we're going to talk about two slots from now, how his career would have been harmed by Shawn Michaels sticking around as well.
So not your top 10. How far do you think you bury him?
I actually thought about when I had considered, there was a brief period where I thought about submitting a list and then doing a list with no Shawn Michaels on it, just to see if anybody noticed that I'd leave him entirely off. Like, There's an old baseball story of it was 1947, and Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams are going for the MVP, and Joe D had his normal excellent season, but Ted Williams won the Triple Crown, or he just missed it by a fraction of a point on batting average, and Ted Williams lost the MVP to Joe DiMaggio by one vote. Because a Boston writer who didn't like Williams because he mouthed off to him one time left him off his ballot despite either winning the Triple Crown or coming within, you know, a hair of winning it.
Well, it's like,
and
when
that's
Jeter,
what it would have been like with Michaels, where I would have not ranked him. It's like, I don't want this guy finishing number one.
It's like,
I didn't do it because if you've ever listened to my podcast, I don't like to be a troll. I hate the Skip Baylessization of media these days, so I'm glad I didn't do it. I probably would have ranked him somewhere in like the 20s or 30s at the end of the day, just because you gotta put him somewhere there.
Yeah, similar to your story there, Jeter, when Morneau won it, one guy from Chicago had Jeter sixth, which is absurd, and someone from Boston had him fourth. So, so... Yeah, MVP balloting could be a interesting podcasting. Someone could just break down every MVP ballot over the years. All right, number 8, the Hot Rod, Piper. Piper, well, oh, I wanted to say HBK is going to be 1 on some people's lists, and I think Piper will be 2. So what are your thoughts on the Hot Rod?
Piper is such an interesting case here because he's not a traditional wrestler,
right? Like, not a great matches per se, right?
I mean, yeah, like you're not gonna see Piper get in there and have him working an arm for 2 minutes and then surgically working on a leg,
right? His best match is versus Brett at WrestleMania 8, right? I mean, is there a better one? Yeah, no, that's the best one.
That's probably the best from like a quote unquote work rate,
right?
Perspective,
yeah, exactly,
certainly.
Yeah.
You know, but his matches were generally always events, and that pretty much starts from day one. He comes in at the same time as Hogan and Schultz and all these other guys. Gene Okerlund debuts around that time as well, and you know, and Piper, everything he did seemed like it was sort of a main event sort of deal from the moment he gets there. Now, they had to start slow with him because he was damaged from the chain match at Starrcade 83. But once he gets going, they slowly ramp it up where he's Hogan's foil. And think about that. Piper is way smaller than Hogan. He's billed at, what, 235 or something like that. But he was always a viable opponent for Hogan because, well, he's just crazy enough to do it. He was a brawler on a pretty high level, I think.
Yeah, 6'2", 230 is what they build him at.
Yeah, it's great brawls with Orndorff in 85 in the aftermath of WrestleMania 1. I should not forget the snooker angle from 84 with the coconut. He should also get points for Piper's Pit, although in kind of watching – you know, TVs and all the Piper's Pit from the period, Piper's Pit could get a little bit repetitive at times where, and that wasn't so much on Piper. It was often on the babyface who would be insulting. And then the babyface would just say, well, at least I don't wear a skirt. Ha ha ha. And then that would be how it would end.
And Piper's Pit key to Hogan Andre.
Yeah. It's all centered around his show. The crowd, we mentioned WrestleMania 2 earlier, cheering him. They couldn't wait to start cheering this guy. So the second he turns with the flower shop, and I think that that was brilliantly done to the point where...
Great match that was at WrestleMania 3.
The flower shop Piper's Pit head-to-head was the first episode of Greetings from Allentown that I did back last year. And the match with Adonis and that whole feud, I wish that we could have gotten another feud out of Piper in that first run, but he retired to go make movies. And then 89, it takes a little while. He's at the WrestleMania. I might be the only person in the world who actually liked the Piper's Pit with Morton Downey Jr.
Oh, I like Love. It. It's a little too long, but I like it.
Oh, it goes way too long. And the Morton Downey Jr. thing is, I think, weird for people of a certain generation that are 5 or 6 years younger than me who are like, who the hell is Morton Downey Jr.? It's like, well, he was basically Rush Limbaugh right before Rush Limbaugh took all of his time slots.
You remember
on
he had
the radio.
Like a CD? He like put a CD out with this. It was like, yeah.
He had a real moment there from like 87 to 89. And then right after they basically got in under the wire on Downey having him at 5 because he made up that story about being assaulted by Nazis or whatever, like literally in April of 89. So that's pretty much farewell to him. But
also one of the least shocking cancer deaths of all time.
Oh God. smoking at all times. Right. Like,
him and Mrs. Draper, the least shocking cancer deaths of all time.
Yeah. Betty Draper, yeah, that's right. He had like the Jackie Gleason thing where he would only light one cigarette a day because he would just light his next cigarette with the last one. But back to Piper, 89 with Rude, that's some strong stuff with the angle playing out on primetime, the interplay with Heenan as well. The stuff he did, and we talked about Brett at 8, the stuff he would do when he would return, like the Lawler match at King of the Ring 94 and returning as the ref at WrestleMania 11, some of that was really hit and miss. Like the referee in the Hart Backlund match, it's like, ugh, yeah, it's not good. Or when he did his run-in on the Hogan-Vince McMahon match at WrestleMania 19, or more accurately, a waddle-in. I believe
well, like
it was.
You've been saying, I mean, everything ends badly or it wouldn't end, right?
That is true. And to his credit, though, the Goldust, what do they call it? The back alley brawl at
WrestleMania 12.
That was actually some fun stuff. And I like when they worked in the OJ footage into the bit there.
Top 10 for you?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Top 5 for you?
Probably not top 5. Okay. In fact, I might have him in the exact same slot as you have him.
All right. The other NCAA national champion.
Yes.
Number 7, The Rock. I initially had The Rock at number 5. And then after much debate, I slid him behind Brett and Randy.
Yep.
Just because I didn't think he was as good as those guys, I guess, is why I ultimately did it. But no, I mean, The Rock is an all-timer. I mean, The Rock is The Rock, right? But he's going to be one on some lists, I think. So,
Yeah.
What do you think about The Rock?
I wouldn't blame people if they put him number one.
Yeah,
I would not have it. But from all the criteria there, and you have like a miscellaneous, and you factor in charisma. He's probably the only guy, I think, that rivals Hulk Hogan from a charisma standpoint. I mean, that's why he is the biggest star that wrestling ever produced. It just wasn't as a wrestler. Sure, he was on the cover of TV Guide and was the biggest star when Austin was injured for that time period in 99 and 2000. But he's the biggest star simply because he is a legitimate movie star on the level that Hulk Hogan wishes that he had become when he started doing movies.
Hogan stayed B-list and The Rock is A-list.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where this guy can
float out there. He opens blockbusters, holiday openings and stuff. Yeah.
And he's a likable star as well. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't be able to get all these roles as he does. Now that I think about it, Mark Wahlberg isn't particularly likable. So strike that from the record. But to the point where he can float out there, you know what I'm thinking about running for president in 2020, and people will believe him.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Iraq.
And like, okay, are we going to have, you know, is he going to call Donald Trump a Rudy Poo candy ass?
That'd be awesome. That'd be funny.
Is he a Democrat? Is he a Republican?
No idea.
Is he a libertarian? Could he run as a libertarian? Probably not. But just thinking of The Rock as a wrestler. I mean, think of how that started for him in '96. In 97, just the way it started out with the failed push. I mean, he could have been like, you know what, this isn't for me. I'm going to go sell insurance. But he stuck with it and reinvented himself. And I know in Pat Patterson's book, he talked about working with Dwayne Johnson, you know, on, you know, improving himself. And when he comes back in 97, it's like the switch went on at some point. I mean, there's one exact point with The Rock.
When he gives the picture to Farouk?
Oh, it was actually before that. When Austin and McMahon are having an argument over the IC title because Austin doesn't want to face The Rock on that Raw. And Rocky's just kind of off to the side watching it, and he kind of pokes his head in and goes, Vince, The Rock thinks you should fire him. And you could hear the crowd sort of chuckle. It's like, that is where The Rock is born, that moment. I remember the message board that I was posting on at that time went nuts over that one particular line. Better matches upon examination, too, which may owe a little bit to the main event style of the time, you know, and maybe even some of the guys that he worked with. I might not like Triple H, but when, you know, The Rock and Triple H seem to have a fairly decent chemistry together. But as I was saying with Shawn Michaels, if Shawn Michaels doesn't leave in 98, he blocks the rise of The Rock. So by Shawn Michaels being out of the picture there, that allows The Rock to become what he did, which is a guy who made way more money than Shawn Michaels ever did for WWE.
Number six. You ready? Oh, wait. Okay. Did I already ask you top 10, The Rock for you? Top 10?
Yeah.
Top five?
Whew.
Maybe.
That would be tough because I'd have a really hard time putting him over some of the guys you have coming up on your list now.
All right, then let's move ahead. Number six. My favorite match of all time, he's a loser. The Macho Man, Randy Savage. Another guy who's going to be on number one in a lot of lists, I'm sure. I can even see him. I think I can only see one of two people winning this, but maybe three. But he's going to be right there. He's going to be high. I love Savage. I've appreciated him more and more over the years. Great match with Warrior at seven, which is hard to do. A guy like... Sometimes I don't love having debates about, like, the best quarterback ever because you just feel like you're splitting hairs. You know, when you get to this part of the list, it's like all these guys are absolute legends, you know, and Savage is another absolute legend, I think.
Well, you know, when it comes in pro wrestling, sometimes you're only as good as your opponent. And you think about Randy Savage from that perspective. He might be Hulk Hogan's best opponent. He is Ricky Steamboat's best opponent, at least from a WWF perspective.
Right.
He's probably also the who am I thinking of here? You got Hogan. You got he's the best opponent for a variety.
You could argue he's the best opponent.
Maybe
for
even Tito Santana, if you prefer Tito versus Macho Man. Instead of Tito versus Valentine,
right.
you could certainly sure. make an argument for that.
Warrior, an argument for Warrior.
Oh, Warrior. Warrior was the name that I was thinking of there. Yeah, I mean, just from WrestleMania 7 alone and, you know, the build-up to that and everything that entailed. His promos are some of the most memorable always intense. I love the intense, real style of promo. And Savage was certainly a master of that. Could be an emotional sort of character, sort of drag you in, like the aforementioned Tuesday in Texas show with Jake and the post-match angle, and then the interview that he did afterwards where he was beating himself up over it and not being able to defend Liz there. You know, his character work, you know, with Liz earlier on, where he's sort of the jealous boyfriend. It was always kind of left vague of the relationship between Savage and Liz, at least after a period of time. And they had an interview on Tuesday Night Titans where they're talking to Gene by the pool, which would lead you to believe that they were husband and wife, which of course in reality they were, but on screen that wasn't really fleshed out or anything like that. A guy who could carry the company in 1988 to allow Hulk Hogan to go and make No Holds Barred one of the greatest pieces of cinema ever. God, I couldn't get the words out with a straight face there. But just that, just being, think about this. I mean, trying to follow a legend where he's effectively trying to follow and maintain the level that Hulk Hogan did and pretty much doing it. He should get some bonus points, I think, for that.
Top 10 for you?
Oh, definitely.
Top 5?
I don't think I would have him in the top 5.
Okay. Number 5 for me, maybe the one you can argue the most about in my top 10, top 5. I'm going to guess some people have him as high as 1 and maybe as low as, I don't know how low you could go, but maybe 10 or 15 even. I've Bret the Hitman Hart. I just love so many of his matches. I love to watch Bret the Hitman Hart wrestle from 1985 all the way through to 97. I mean, I just love to watch his matches. I love them as a tag. I love them as a single. I love them as an IC. And I love them as a champion. The top 4 in my mind are the top 4 ironclad. So this is as high as he could go. But I just love watching him work. I know he wasn't great at promos necessarily, but he'd get a line out like at SummerSlam 90 when he references Two Hearts by Phil Collins, which I just thought was perfect the way he did it, and didn't even come off as corny. I think more than anyone, he is where he is because I love watching him actually wrestle in the ring. I loved his matches, so.
Now, the critique about him is, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with his grumpy old man persona.
Yeah, he's serious. He's a little too serious.
But when you look at all the things that have happened to Bret Hart since November of 1997, I can't blame him for feeling the way he does.
Right.
About anything, for all that he's had to endure. But putting that aside, it took a while for him to find his footing there because people forget the Hart Foundation were not really a pushed entity until really the point where they got the tag titles. They're losing to the Killer Bees in 86. And while the Bees were not like jobbers or anything, it's not like the Killer Bees were a top team. I mean, they're next level down at best. So they get that break there because the Bulldogs will only lose the titles to them. And Bret gets elevated by that. And, you know, you had those aborted singles pushes with Bret where I think that they were just – they knew that they had something special, but I don't think they were entirely sure of how to use it.
Right, it started quite in 88 with that, you know, at WrestleMania 4. Yeah.
I mean, he got – the problem there is that he got pigeonholed with Bad News Brown, who Bret in his book talks about was a pain in the butt to work with because Bad News would just suck up all of the offense and would hardly
talk about taking yourself too seriously. He out-bred his Bret in that category, right?
Yeah, Bret looks like an everyday, you know, a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, Jerry Seinfeld.
The improv compared with Bad News Brown. But he always took great care in his matches, and I'm not talking about the Hitman's, oh, I never injured anybody in the ring. It's that he would craft the matches. Storytelling was part of the element for Bret. And that's why I love that Bret Owen match from WrestleMania 10 so much.
Good. Yeah, so good.
I mean, it's such a great finish, too, because of just the way it hits, where you see him going for that move, and then it just gets cut off by Owen, and you get the pinfall. that way. Brett deserves credit also for being a guy who was enormously popular, not only in Canada, which is the obvious thing, because he basically ensured that the WWF was going to have hegemony in Canada, and WCW didn't even try to challenge that, even after they got Brett. He was also very popular in Europe, too.
Germany.
I might be relying too much on Brett's book there in his own accounts, but it does seem that, you know, Brett was a monstrous star over there.
Pritchard has since vouched for that. So
yeah. I mean, and you know, match after match, he helped make Steve Austin at Survivor Series '96, and then later in the WrestleMania submission match. So that's another
perfect match.
Another point in his favor, I think the Iron Man match at 12 is a little overrated because
it's kind of boring. They should add falls.
I did not like the 0-0 business. You could have done 1-1, and just because those two guys couldn't agree on which one would lose the first fall, it's like, first of all, you should have had Brett win the first fall because then you have Sean overcome that
and then
win the title. I mean, that's you know how they. How they should have done it.
And they should have had it where he's down 1-0 like in the last minute and saves it. And then there's confusion on, is it just going to be a tie? And then Gorilla says, no, it's sudden death. And then he wins it. But
Brett's another guy who you could say is the best opponent for a wide variety of guys. Like Diesel, Kevin Nash, he gets the match that he got out of him at King of the Ring 94. And you know, the British Bulldog at SummerSlam 92, Piper. Mr. Perfect, SummerSlam 91. Oh, like the list goes on. And it's interesting to think about, you know, if Brett had been healthy and didn't have all the bad baggage and could have come back, say, in 2000, how that might have looked. But
top 10? No.
Oh, definitely.
Top 5.
I would say so, yes, from his he was the excellence of execution, even though I should point out that Gorilla Monsoon used to say that about Bob Orton first, and then he transferred it on to Brett slowly as 1987 went along. I always kind of enjoyed how Gorilla kind of paying back Stu Hart for training him all those years ago.
So we would have the same top five, right?
Pretty much.
I mean, not necessarily in that order, but.
Yeah, the next one might be tough for a lot of people. So what's your number four?
My number four is Bruno. Bruno is the reason that was a company for almost two decades. I mean, Bruno's the first superstar they ever had. I mean, he's the reason they didn't have to be part of the NWA. And, I mean, he is. It was hard not to put Bruno number one, to be honest, but it was more regional when Bruno was on top, which is why I put him four. But Bruno is, I mean, he's a living legend, and, you know, he was the company for longer than almost anyone. I mean, I give my number three so much credit for how long he's been able to work at up top, and Bruno did the same thing for years in the hardest place at Madison Square Garden, and, you know, he had to end that second run, too. They didn't want to stop it for all things ending badly, otherwise they wouldn't. You know, Bruno was the one who wanted to end that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Vince Sr. wanted him to go on a little longer, I think. So, at least if you listen to Bruno's account. But
yeah.
No, I think that my top four is the top four. Like, I have a hard time arguing. Like, I see why people would put someone like Savage or The Rock in. Like, I get it. Or HBK. But, like, I feel like I'm right. No, these are the top four. I feel almost the strongest about these guys being the Mount Rushmore more than anything.
Three and your number three, who we'll get to in a sec, and Bruno are forever linked from, as you said, the longevity perspective. And they couldn't be further apart in terms of the era in which they worked. But with Bruno... Okay, you got – it's basically 1963 to 1981 with a few spurts where he took time off, like in the early 70s and then in the very late 70s. The matches themselves are just magic because nobody of that era could connect with the people like Bruno did. And he's a very underrated promo, in my opinion. You just watch him, and it's very serious, and he's talking directly to the people. And a lot of my exposure to Bruno, and it's kind of, you know, a lack of footage. And yeah, there's some Bruno versus Waldo Von Erich from 75 on the network and stuff like that. But it always comes back to me to the Bruno and Larry angle, which is as good as anything the WWE has ever run in its entire history. And it's hilarious that Vince Sr. apparently didn't want to do the angle, and Bruno had to talk him into it. I mean, you know, literally the best thing that they would ever do, which I did cover on a Greetings from Allentown episode number 14. It's one of the longer ones, but it's because it's such a long and winding story with Larry and Bruno. And just, you know, I think people kind of get colored by some of Bruno's later stuff and how angry he was towards Vince McMahon in the direction of wrestling in general. And I always saw him as a bit of an old fogey when I was a teenager. Like, why is Bruno always like fighting, you know, why is he always fighting for the past here? And it's something that I've come to understand because there was damage to certain elements of pro wrestling over time. Like he certainly made some good points, whether people want to admit it or not. And, you know, the fact that you can draw as many sellouts at Madison Square Garden, being the guy on top for 8 years. And yeah, they didn't have monthly pay-per-views back then, but your monthly pay-per-view was basically the MSG
Garden.
Show.
Yeah, the Garden.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's drawing a full house there almost every single time.
And if he didn't blame himself, he blamed whoever he was wrestling, and that guy was gone and it was on to the next one, right? So he had the perfect cover there.
And by all accounts, you know, Bruno was very good to the other wrestlers, and not just his cronies. I've seen that from, I think it was from J.J. Dillon's book where he talks about that with Bruno. I think there's something in Gary Hart's book as well about how Bruno was good to him.
Yeah, Bruno, man, Bruno. Let's talk more, because I think we got to get these other three out there, because I think we're going to kind of talk to them as like kind of a quadrant here. But number three, I rank John Cena. Now, look, I know there's people, the Cena sucks people. I don't get it. I was checked out for a lot of Cena's run, and when I came back, he was instantly the best part of the show to me. I mean, he's so good. He's just so good. And I think him being good turned so many people around. You know, I think maybe I was lucky that I missed some of the fatigue that set in with him and was able to kind of cherry pick his career a little bit. But, man, he had a great year. He had a 5-star match not even that long ago, a triple threat match. I want to say at Royal Rumble or SummerSlam, one of them. 5 stars. So good. He's so good. He's great at – he's just great. I love him. I love watching him. Like, if I find out he's going to be on next week, I'll turn it on. Like, he makes me turn on – pro wrestling in 2018 for 2018 wrestling, not even something from the 80s. Like, I want to see him work, and I admire the fact that he's been able to stay on top as long as he has in the era that he's done it. And I don't think he belongs any lower than three. I think there's only two guys who deserve to be ranked ahead of him in my mind. I could see a few cases, but I think he's just so good. I really do. What do you think of Cena?
Yeah, I don't think he's necessarily automatic top three. I think anybody who ranks him lower than 10 is just doing themselves a disservice and not kind of taking everything into account. And they're not necessarily being fair to Cena, who's far better in ring than people give him credit for. Obviously, the charisma is there as well. There's a connection with at least the kids, maybe not so much with the adults, but it's very important, people forget, to connect with kids who are watching wrestling, because how the hell are you going to have the next generation of wrestling fans?
Right, and if, I mean, he's a guy who's done 500+ Make-A-Wishes. I mean, he's taken the wrestler, you know, and made him like a good, like he's a good guy. Like everyone admires him in a way, you know.
And he never he hasn't had some of the same baggage.
Right, he hasn't embarrassed like, them in, ever.
There are a couple of things with Cena that there, you know, I myself kind of had like I generally love guys who come from my area of the country. Like if you're from Massachusetts, unless you're a Wahlberg,
yeah, everyone does this.
I will defend you. Like I'm a guy who loves Jay Leno over David Letterman in part for that reason. Mm-hmm. Also because I think Letterman mailed in like the last 20 years of his career, but that's neither here nor there. Cena. Okay. Even in 2014, I was like, oh, I'm just sick of him, whatever. And then I had that moment. And it was during that Royal Rumble 2015 triple threat match with Rollins and Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, that's so good.
There's a point in the match where he puts up his hand for the five knuckle shuffle. And of course, this being in Philly, they start booing vociferously. And he smiles and proceeds like he, and I'm like, oh my God, this guy's amazing. He never breaks. He never breaks. Nothing can faze him. A lot of guys, like a Shawn Michaels, will let stuff get to them in the ring and have it affect their performance. I'm thinking of the Michaels versus Davey Boy match at one of the In Your House pay-per-views from 96, where he let stuff bother him. Cena, nothing gets to him. He's 100% professional. I find, despite all the stuff of, well, he should have jobbed to the Nexus at SummerSlam 2010, he's incredibly unselfish, especially in recent years with the AJ Styles and all that. He's, if anything, he's a victim of being relied on too much by WWE for his entire era. To kind of put it in a way that would really speak to both you and me, it's kind of like being a hockey team. You have an 82-game season, and you have a star goaltender, and you're going to be a playoff team, but using your star goaltender for 80 out of the 82 games and never playing your backup. Like, that's what they were doing with Cena in terms of they were really relying on him a lot, especially it seemed like in 2014 after, like, they went back to Cena, and they were just terrified of doing anything else. And people, you know, Cena did okay with it. And it's like, why do people want to punish him for, you know, him being overused here?
Right. He was in the Booker.
He's good. He's great. Yeah. He's not pulling creative control. You know, I know that whole Nexus story or whatever, but who cares? I mean, take out that one instance. There's probably 50 instances of it going the other way.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely a Mount Rushmore guy. I think if you don't have him in your top four, you're doing it a disservice. You said 10, I say 4. Now, the top two, to me, when I thought about this, I said it's either this guy or this guy for number one. And it was immediately that I came to that conclusion. So number two, ultimately, I decided is Stone Cold Steve Austin. Stone Cold is the second, right? Like he's the second huge star, right? Like he's the reason for the second boom. I don't even think it's as much the NWO stuff and the Monday Night Wars. I think it's Steve Austin's the reason for that boom. Because without Austin, there's no war. WCW just wins, I think.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just couldn't see him being, I mean, people will rank him lower than two, I'm sure. But to me, I think he's going to win. He's my vote. If I were going to guess, I think he's going to win.
I do think Austin will probably end up winning. And I think the debate between you did say number one, Hulk Hogan, right?
Number one is Hulk Hogan. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Austin and Hogan is in comparing their two runs is basically a debate over, at least from a longevity perspective, about monthly pay-per-view versus quarterly pay-per-view. Because Hogan, you're running quarterly pay-per-views for most of his run. Early on, there really wasn't – it was just WrestleMania for
right,
the first
not even quarterly at first.
Years.
Yeah.
And so you think of it as – if you think of each – the period between each pay-per-view as one unit, Austin's going through 12 units per year whereas Hogan's going through 4 units per year or 3 units per year, something like that. So Austin's longevity is actually, well, I think he was actually helped by being away with that injury. Of course, the injury ended up sinking his career entirely, as it turned out. But when you're debating the longevity of the two guys, Austin had the higher high, I think, just from the money perspective. I think Hogan was more famous, though, just in the mid-80s.
Yeah, I think Hogan had a greater – the reason I put Hogan ahead is I thought he – well, one big reason I put him ahead was he was able to come back in the 2000s and have that match against Rock.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, maybe Austin could have done that with Lesnar at WrestleMania 30, but he just chose not to. Or maybe 31, whatever it was, the one in Dallas. What one was that? That wasn't 30. 31 or 32.
That was 32, yeah.
Yeah, he maybe could have had that kind of a match against Brock, but, you know, he decided not to do it. So I don't know if I'm holding that against him per se, but it actually happened for Hogan. Like, it happened. And, it blew my mind at the time, just, you know, the way he got over in that period. And I just think when I think of wrestling, and if I asked 1,000 people who didn't like wrestling, never watched it, who's the greatest wrestler of all time? I'm just pretty sure Hogan's going to be the response for the most. Hulk Hogan. He's the wrestler. Hulk Hogan is the wrestler to me.
Yeah.
And to many. So.
I mean, often it kind of goes back to the thing we were talking about at the beginning of this show, which is when you're nurtured, when you're introduced to it in a certain era, you're going to be kind of attached to who the top guy was during that time period. So any child of the 80s and early 90s, it's going to be Hogan unless you just feel so much baggage with some of the things in his life later on. But let's just consider his career in WWE here. You know, he made that company a worldwide entity. There's no denying it. It's he is the main driving force behind that. So really, you can't create Austin to that level unless you have Hogan first paving the way.
Right. People always say like Hogan took it from regional to national, but he also took it international. Like, they didn't stop at national.
And you know, there was mainstream publicity for wrestling beforehand, just from a territorial perspective. But with cable TV coming in, somebody was going to go national, and the company that was going to go national was probably going to be the one that would get the biggest star, or at least utilize the biggest star properly, and that was Hulk Hogan. And they just did it better than anybody else could.
I feel really confident about my top four. Like, I feel really, when I look at my list, like, not everyone's going to like tag team wrestling as much as me. Not as many people are going to discount the last 10 years as much as me, maybe. They'll have more guys from that era. There's many people, obviously, are going to have women's wrestlers in there. There's going to be people, absolutely, I know there's going to be people who don't have Haiti Kidd on their list. I'm not sure why, but there are going to be people out there who don't include him. But one thing I feel like, if I had to argue my list, the thing I feel most passionate about is arguing my top four. Because I really do feel like that's the Mount Rushmore of WWF wrestling. Those four guys. Bruno for creating the company. Hogan for taking it international. Austin for being the one who made Vince a billionaire. And Cena for being the one who's been able to run with it for all these years and, you know, take it public, I guess. So I just feel really good about those four guys as the Rushmore. But this has gone on and on and on. So let's kind of close it up if anyone is still with us. Well, you know, I'm going to pitch it like this because people complain about the Pritchard Show being long. I always say, like, they do one a week. Just listen to an hour a day. You know, well, we're only doing one of these ever. So just listen to it, you know. You figure you're going to live 80 years, prorate that, and listen to 6 minutes a day if you have to.
You know, on my podcast, I make it a point never to go 2 hours. Like, I never want to hit 2 hours with any show because it seems patently ridiculous because I limit myself to a 1 hour wrestling program for one guy to talk about it for 2 hours would be a bit of overkill. So if you ever notice, sometimes I rush through the end of the show. It's when I feel like I'm up against the clock there for 2 hours. And we're at I don't know where we're at now. We're in the high 2 hours right now, I think.
Who would be your number one?
My number one probably would be Hogan, just simply because the charisma is off the charts and the money that he drew. It's kind of hard to argue with all of that, really. I mean, even if you take it just from quote unquote, I know I keep saying quote unquote work rate, but you know, Hogan would have a good match when he needed to. I mean, he carried that Warrior match at WrestleMania 6, which, while it's not a five-star Tokyo Dome classic or anything like that, it's still a very watchable match with the story being told.
And it's a main event. It's a main event.
Yep.
You know, I was there, and you knew when the main event was on. I was there, and I could barely see the ring, and the people around me could barely see the ring. But everyone couldn't take their eyes off of it when the main event started. You know, like, that was the main event. So, well, this was fun. I like breaking this down. It was my list. So we got to talk about a lot of wrestlers, obviously, I like. So that was cool. That was fun. Pete, why don't you tell everyone about Greetings from Allentown and where they can find it and listen to it and all that.
Hey, Greetings from Allentown is my podcast that I do, taking a look at a weekly TV of a wrestling show from the past. So, like, recently I did a NWA Pro episode from May of 1990, and I just kind of looked at that one week, what was going on in the NWA/WCW, broke down all the matches, commented on what those guys were doing, infused a little bit of pop culture commentary along the way. And sometimes I like to run a little vanity segment at the end of the show where I talk about other stuff, comment on these are all videos that I'll take off of YouTube. So it's readily available. You can kind of watch along with me. I've covered WCW shows, WWF shows from the 80s and 90s. There's an ECW one in there, even some Bill Watts era Mid-South UWF. And as I said, I don't go over 2 hours on any of the shows. Just run from 1 hour, 2 hours. You can check me out on SoundCloud, which is where it's hosted, or on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And be sure to subscribe to that to also catch all the other great shows that are posted there. Far too many to name. There's been a lot dropping this week. So
thanks to all the thanks to Place to Be Nation for just doing this, doing all the legwork and as far as tabulating the results and putting out the pieces. And it's really a great project, a lot of fun to be a part of it on Facebook and all that. And also my podcast, the Sportscasters Podcast, is in between seasons right now, but I do have an interview scheduled for Monday we're going to run this later. The day after the NFC Championship game, I will speak with the guy who called it, Joe Buck. We'll be on for the Season 8 premiere of the Sportscasters, which will probably be posted by the time you listen to this, and it's on SoundCloud as well.
In a time warp.
Yeah, we're in a time warp, so I don't know what I'm supposed to say. But it will be up, I'm sure, by the time this airs. You can listen to my appearance to Joe Buck. Now, I will say this as far for Joe Buck, because people hate Joe Buck. You're wrong. If you think Joe Buck is a bad guy, you don't like him, I want to promise you, you're wrong. Moments after the Saints had lost to the Vikings in the division round, and I guess what most people would call a classic, I was sitting in a haze on the arm of my couch while my family was filing out of the building. They were going home. And I didn't know what to do, and I text Joe Buck, and I said, "That hurt. I know I'm going to have to watch that play forever, but at least your awesome call will be over top of it. Congratulations." And before I put my phone down, and this is, I mean, I don't even think Fox is off the air, but before I put my phone down, the little bubbles showed up in the message, and he responded by saying, "Ha, sorry, brother, head to hurt. Great game, though." So, Joe Buck, he's a great guy, I'm telling you. If you hate him, you're wrong about him.
And by the way, you know, he's really, really good on baseball. I particularly point to the 2016 World Series as some of his best work there. But also, don't forget, Joe Buck, really great on the TV show Brockmire last year on IFC. He did, I think it was a two-episode arc there on the The show starring Hank Azaria, and if you could check that out either on demand or whatever, I highly recommend that as well.
All right, Pete, we should wrap this up, huh?
Oh yeah,
the Sabres are losing again as we talk.
Oh, well, some things are just standing headlines. I'm sorry.
No, hey, they've won like 10 games all year, so I mean,
yeah,
yeah, you know, they're miserable. All right, buddy, this was fun. I will I'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks.
Face the path.